vehicle, the suspect, or the child described in the alert, call 911. Sign up today at wirelessamberalerts.org. A child is calling for help. This message brought to you by the Wireless Foundation, the U.S. Department of Justice, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and the Ad Council.
Time now for another edition of the Wake Up Call with Liz Brown. Views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or advertisers of WGNU Radio. This broadcast is a production of Norman Broadcasting Company, Incorporated, and WGNU Radio, and is intended solely for the information and entertainment of our listening audience. Any rebroadcast, transcribing, recording, or other use of this material without the expressed written consent of Norman Broadcasting Company, Incorporated, and WGNU Radio is strictly prohibited. We ask that you govern your calls within the bounds of brevity and good taste. And now, the Wake Up Call with Liz Brown.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air.
Liz Brown is out today. We will bring you the best of the Wake Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
Welcome back to the Wake Up Call. This is Liz Brown, living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number. 454-6609 is my fax. You need to get up. You need to get to me. We have much, much, much to talk about. From the Iraqi war to back home again, this hour we are going to be talking about the environment with Robert Devine, author of Bush versus the Environment, joining us from Oregon. Robert, good morning.
Good morning, Liz. How are you?
I'm outstanding. How are you?
Fine, especially after hearing Santa Baby.
By Eartha Kitt! Robert, I don't know where to begin. Bush sets out to dismantle 30 years worth of environmental laws. Bush unlikely to change the ocean policies. The EPA is getting ready to reverse a sewage standard. The U.S. is firmly anti-Kyoto Treaty. Where do we begin?
Well, you know, it is hard sometimes not to feel overwhelmed by it. I completely appreciate that feeling. When I started out writing the book, I had exactly the same feeling in a major way.
So let's talk about Bush dismantling 30 years of environmental law. And the thing I find interesting about that is that a lot of these laws were established by Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford.
Yeah, there's a long Republican history with environmental laws. Now, with somebody like President Nixon, it may not have been that he was such a staunch environmentalist at heart, but he was a political creature and realized it was where the American public wanted to go, so he went with it. But he was certainly more moderate in his views than our current president. And whether all those 30 years' worth of laws gets dismantled remains to be seen. Hopefully the public's support for them will save some of them or parts of some of them. But there's if you want a place to start looking, I would say one thing people could do is, and they may not want to hear this because it can be painful, but to learn more about it and read more and listen more. And find out all the little things, or not all of them, but a sampling of the little things that are going on that undermine those laws. Because, sad to say, in many ways, it's worse than it looks if you just read the headlines.
So let's talk about some of the little things that are going on that are undermining and dismantling these laws.
Well, I would start, again, there are many choices, let's say with lack of enforcement or poor enforcement, weak enforcement. Sometimes we have these environmental laws and people in the Bush administration will say that they are abiding by them and they're not trying to undermine them, and in fact the laws are intact. But if they're not properly enforced and strongly enforced, and if there's not a lot of serious monitoring to make sure that they're being enforced, they do us little good on the ground. A perfect example are the various air pollution standards that are slipping. And, in fact, it slipped already in the first term quite a bit. But I think we're going to see a lot more of that in the second term. And these things, air pollution laws, have such a direct impact and their enforcement on people's lives. I would just point to a section of Pennsylvania down the southwest corner that I visited when I was writing the book. But it could stand in for a lot of communities in the Midwest and in the East and in the South, where the old coal-fired power plants are still prevalent. There aren't so many of those plants out west, but in most of the country, they're still quite common. There are hundreds of them. When I say old, I'm talking about the ones that were built before the Clean Air Act came into effect. They're very old, and they weren't built with air pollution in mind at all. And there was an amendment to the Clean Air Act passed in 1977 that was supposed to basically take care of these old plants over the course of a few years. The idea was to give them some time to either close down or to put modern pollution control equipment on the plants, which is expensive but not prohibitive. It would not break the bank. They would still make a profit and get along just fine, because the ones that have done that have gone along okay over the years. But it was not enforced under Reagan and under George Bush the First. It just sort of stayed in limbo for many years. And then under Clinton, toward the end of the Clinton administration, they began to seriously enforce this for the first time. And they brought actions against several dozen plants. And the utilities began settling, and the process was moving right along toward actual on-the-ground results. But when Bush came into office, that just clanked to a halt. They claim that they continued to enforce it, but the truth is, when you look at the statistics, that they've stopped almost all of those actions except the ones that were so far along they couldn't stop.
And the EPA is responsible for the enforcement of these.
They are.
Okay. Now, what I think is interesting also, Robert, is the fact that people may not understand that the EPA as an agency, the staff of the EPA does not change with each incoming president, but just coincidentally that almost a third of the people that are the staff members of the EPA will become eligible for retirement over Bush's next 4 years, which will allow him to make even more appointments to people that would be lenient to polluters.
Yeah.
So we have that coming at us, too. So we already have the lack of enforcement. Now we're going to have a means that enforcement is going to be continued to be lax.
Yeah, there's always that struggle between the political appointees and the permanent or semi-permanent staff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something we probably should talk about down the line because it's quite interesting, this administration. But as you point out, there's going to be some massive turnover, but there already were a fair number of high-level people in the Enforcement Division who quit very famously. And they quit.
Christine Todd Whitman being one of them.
Yeah, that's true, the head administrator. Now, she did not criticize the Bush administration when she quit, but others who quit over the lack of enforcement were very pointed in their criticism, and in their retirement letters, they were quite clear that they were quitting because they thought the administration was doing such a poor job of enforcing the laws. A prominent one was Eric Schaefer, who quit a couple of years ago. He was the head of enforcement that had to do with air pollution. And I think part of that is he looked at the numbers, and he was the one who primarily had started those enforcement actions under Clinton, although his tenure goes back to George Bush the first, I believe.
Well, and also I think it would be helpful for people to understand and to give some more light on some of the areas that really are the target of this continued administration or the second term of George W. Bush. One of the things that this administration is going to have their eye on is the act that would allow for mining in the Arctic.
For the oil and gas
exactly.
drilling.
Yes, I'm sorry.
The whole energy bill, of which that's a part, you know, that stalled out in the first term. And, you know, it's one of those massive bills that has some elements that environmentalists would probably like, many elements they would not, and some that are falling into the gray area in between. It's so hard when something is that massive to make a broad statement about it, but if I were forced to make one, I would say we could do a lot better than that bill. And one of the provisions, like you point out, that I think is probably not such a good one is the drilling up in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
And talk to us about why is that problematic? Why isn't that a good idea to drill for oil in an Arctic wildlife refuge? It just sounds so awful to say. It sounds so obvious. But, I mean, why is that such an awful thing?
Well, I guess you could say it's not obvious. I agree when you just say it. It does sound like what's to argue. But you could certainly make the argument that we need to have greater energy independence, that it would produce jobs, that it would boost the economy. You know, there are a number of arguments to be made, but there are so many counter-arguments to be made. And the first one is that we don't have that many intact wild places of that size and quality left on the planet. And the trade-off just in that sense, I think, is probably a very dubious one. We have more oil than we really should have. You know, I mean, we're running out of it, but we need to be weaning ourselves off of oil for all sorts of reasons. And just producing more is not really getting us going in the direction I think most people would agree we need to go for political reasons, for military reasons, certainly for environmental reasons.
And 2 years ago, the Senate defeated the plan to exploit the refuge. I think it was a vote of 52-48. Do you see that ratio holding up this term?
Not necessarily. I'm not an expert on the Congress,
mm-hmm.
but I know with the influx of Republican members that that's in danger. I'm not sure if those few moderate Republican senators can hold out. You know, the public can play a large role there. If people wonder what they can do about something like this, there's a very specific example. It was widely agreed that it was the public's outrage at the idea of drilling in Anwar that really bolstered those moderate Republicans to give them the political backing to be able to say no to the president. So I hope people who are constituents of those moderate few, or just anyone in the country who's concerned about that. But there are other elements of the energy bill, too, that I would be looking out for.
Well, one of the components of it is a component that would allow for the, for businesses to investigate new tracts of land for oil and for gas, and also building of nuclear power stations.
Yeah, it's really kind of...
When you say it's a huge bill that has a whole lot of things in it, building of nuclear power stations?
Yeah, it's a bill that looks backwards in many ways. It's not looking to the real future that most people think we need to go to. You know, it supports a lot of coal and nuclear and oil and gas, certainly. And that's one of the things, too. I think there's been so much focus on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which certainly deserves attention. I think it tends to distract people from what's going on in the lower 48 states. And there's a lot of oil and gas exploration and drilling going on down here now. It's greatly accelerated under Bush.
And why is that problematic?
Well, if you were, say, a rancher in Wyoming, you would know the answer by looking out your window. You know, it's really been ironic to see a lot of people who are rock-ribbed Republicans, great supporters of George Bush, who are now just flabbergasted at what that administration is doing, literally in their backyards. A lot of the people out there who own ranches or farms do not own the subsurface rights, meaning the right to drill for oil or mine for gold is not theirs. And an outfit who buys those rights, and they don't buy it from the ranch or farmer, they buy it from the government. They can move right in there and build the roads they need and the oil derricks they need and other infrastructure, and they can put those up 100 yards from a ranch house.
And I am certain that 99.9% of Americans don't know that.
No, it's, you know, well, we have a lot of things on our plate, as always, but I think more than ever because of the war and the threat of terrorism. I think people just will not know the details of this because it has been covered in the media, and unless you live in Wyoming, how else are you going to know about it?
Mm-hmm.
So the problems out there are the problems in many other states where the oil and gas drilling is going on. For instance, with those ranchers, it's not just an aesthetic problem. It also tends to pollute their groundwater and kills their grass. And as ranchers will always tell you, they don't raise cows, they raise grass. That's what does it for them.
Mm.
And so that's a major problem for them. Other places, it's a wilderness issue. A lot of lands that don't have official wilderness designation, and that's something we're also, you know, running short on in this country. Those are important lands both for recreation, but also for a lot of biological services. They provide us with many things that are important, you know, clean water and clean air and so forth. And
and speaking of clean water, it's my understanding also that this administration will be attempting to reverse our sewage standard.
That's something I don't know much about. That's come on since I've done the book, but
mm-hmm.
I have heard that there. If you're thinking about the stormwater,
exactly.
the mixing, yeah.
Yes.
That was kind of percolating during the first term, and I guess that's coming along now, and it's, I think, a big issue in Ohio and perhaps in Missouri as well, out in the Midwest in particular.
Yes.
You might be able to tell me more about that, actually, than I know.
Well, actually, what we need to do right now is we need to take a break. I'm talking to Robert Devine, author of Bush versus the Environment. He's joining us from Oregon. Stay with us, folks. This is Liz Brown, the wake-up call. You need to get to me. We have much to talk about. We'll take
You are listening to the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU. Morning, St. Louis, 29 minutes after the hour of 6 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton. Let's take a look at your traffic and weather for this 6 o'clock hour. Eastbound 40 between Maryville Center and Mason Road. Look for heavy volume, but everything's moving at the speed limit. Northbound 270 between 44 and Big Bend. Slow traffic to report. Westbound 5570 from 3rd Street into the Poplar Street Bridge. You've got heavy volume going on there. Westbound 64 from the Ball Avenue interchange into 5570. Look for some delays. Eastbound 70 from Bryan Road through 79. Look for slow traffic. Northbound 270 at 70. Look for delays in the right lane as you approach the 70 exits. Consequently, eastbound 70 between just west or just east of the Earth City Expressway through St. Charles Rock Road. Look for some delays around the 70 interchange. Northbound 270 is now stop and go from Gravoy through Big Bend, so look for some delays there as well. Northbound 55 from Butler Hill through 270, look for heavy volume, and then again from 3200 South Broadway into 44, look for some delays. And that is a look at your traffic. Now let's take a look at your forecast for today, tomorrow, and for Thursday. For today, look forward to partly sunny skies this morning, mostly cloudy by this afternoon, a chance of showers and thunderstorms with a high in the mid-80s. This evening, showers and thunderstorms likely with a low around 60. Wednesday, cooler, showers and thunderstorms likely, a high in the lower 70s. Wednesday evening, showers and thunderstorms to continue with a low in the upper 50s. And Thursday, showers and thunderstorms will continue as well with a high in the lower 70s. Currently in the studios of AM 920 WGNU, we have overcast skies, 71 degrees, Lambert Fields reporting 72. Stay tuned for more of Liz Brown. Actually, the best of the wake-up call is up next. Liz Brown is out today. She will be back tomorrow morning beginning at 6 a.m. in the studio. Up next, more of the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton. We'll take another look at your news, traffic, and weather at the top of the 7 o'clock hour. This is AM 920 WGNU, your station for the issues that matter most to you.
Are you one of those people who look at somebody who's big boned and think that's just a euphemism for Twinkie enriched? Are you sick of the idea that we can go to war in Serbia and bomb the crud out of them, but we should stay out of Iraq? If the whole entire pop culture thing, Britney Spears, Super Bowl commercials, and all that stuff gets on your nerves, well, guess what? It gets on mine, too. So if you want someone to listen and understand, listen to me, Brett Rosen, every Tuesday, 10 a.m. on WGNU, 920 a.m.
I'm Field Person of Person Roofing. We've been in business about 17 years, and we've advertised on WGNU almost that whole time. We have installed over 5,000 roofs in that period of time, and today I have a customer here. His name is Mr. Merriweather. Mr. Merriweather, I think we installed a roof on your house about 10 or 12 years ago.
Yes, you did.
Recently, you had a little storm damage on that roof, didn't you?
I sure did.
Can you tell what happened?
Yeah, Mr. Person come out and repaired my roof and didn't charge me anything.
And you haven't had any problems since we did a repair?
I sure haven't.
Even though your warranty was out, we still came out and took care of your roof.
Right.
We try to service our customers, and if you would like to have a new roof, call us at 361-7127. That's Person Roofing at 361-7127. All phases of roofing.
At the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee, my parents keep on telling me, just being here is winning.
Okay, spellers, please take your seats. I'd like to announce the results of the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. From the New York Times, gold stars all around for this riotously funny and remarkably ingenious new musical. Can you spell irresistible?
I-R-R-E-S.
No, dear, that was rhetorical.
Rhetorical. R-H-E-T-O-R-I-C-A-L.
Moving on, the Wall Street Journal calls Spelling Bee that rarity of rarities. A super smart show that's also a bona fide crowd pleaser.
Bona what?
And Associated Press calls Spelling Bee a winner and asks, how do you spell hit?
Ooh, I know this one.
Find out how much you know at Spelling Bee. At the Fox Theater, May 8th through the 20th. Tickets through MetroTix, part of the U.S. Bank Broadway series, sponsored by American Airlines.
The University of Missouri St. Louis presents the Associated Black Collegians Health and Wellness Fair on Monday, May 7th from 11 to 3. It takes place at the Millennium Student Center on the campus of UMSL in Century Rooms A through C. The fair includes free food, massages, and health screenings. For more info, call 314-516-5731. Something for your health from AM 920.
This is the award-winning wake-up call with Liz Brown. Don't leave home without it.
Now we take you back to the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back to the wake-up call. This is Liz Brown. I'm living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number. I am talking to Robert Devine, author of Bush versus the Environment, joining us from Oregon. And welcome back, Robert.
Thank you, Liz.
Talk to us about the Clean Air Act and this administration's relationship with that act.
Well, it certainly isn't a healthy relationship. I would think if they were a person, they would be on the psychiatrist's couch on this one. As you know, this administration has a strong oil background. And I think to understand their relationship with the Clean Air Act, you have to understand they're coming from an oil man's perspective and a kind of a Texas perspective.
A failed oil man's perspective.
Well, that too. That's another point. And they have a lot of friends and relatives and former business acquaintances who are all in the oil business and in the related businesses, the oil refineries and the utilities that use oil and so forth. And in addition, of course, we have the campaign contributions, which were huge coming from the sectors of the economy, like the oil refiners and the utility owners, who account for an awful lot of our air pollution. And so with that background, you have to see that they're not particularly fond of the Clean Air Act. We already discussed their weak enforcement of it. And in fact, recently, about 2 months ago, the Inspector General of the EPA came out, and this is at the Bush EPA, understanding that it's not easy for a report like this to surface there, but the Inspector General came out with a report very critical of the Bush administration's, of the EPA's performance when it comes to the Clean Air Act. So anyway, the Clean Air Act goes back to 1970, and the amendments I was talking about in 77 were crucial for these utilities, and they put out about half of much of the worst pollution. Fine particulate matter, for example, which are basically just microscopic bits of soot that get very deep into the lungs. They're one of the most damaging aspects of air pollution. And these 1977 amendments were supposed to take care of that along with some other things. But without the enforcement, they have not. And the Bush administration proposed a new rule for what's called new source review, which relates to those 77 amendments. And when they proposed that, it greatly weakened it. About 95% of the companies that were out of compliance under the old version of the Clean Air Act amendments were suddenly, if this were to pass, it's still a proposal, but they would be in compliance. So, the great majority of the pollution would continue from these old coal-fired plants for a long time. And reports have shown several very good studies by Harvard and the American Cancer Society and some other organizations have shown that 20 to 25,000 people a year are dying from fine particulate matter related illnesses. Tens of thousands of people have heart attacks. 600,000 people are having asthma attacks, and maybe 25% or 25,000 of those are emergencies. It goes on and on. The health repercussions of fine particulate matter and poor enforcement of the Clean Air Act are just enormous. And I would assume that back where you are in Missouri, you'd be feeling this.
Oh, it's very much so. Very much so.
Now, you're right where a lot of these plants are.
Exactly.
And all through the Midwest is just particularly horrendous. You know, like I mentioned, I had spent time in this little corner of southeast Pennsylvania, right on the West Virginia border. And I suspect their problems are similar to those in Missouri and Ohio and through that center of the country, especially because the wind blows east primarily, so they're getting a lot of Ohio's pollution. And
well, we did a show a few days ago about the top 100 polluters, and about five of those corporations are headquartered right here in Missouri, in St. Louis, actually.
Wow, that's a high percentage.
Yes, it is. Yes,
that's very high. And I don't know, you know, there are various polluters who would come under various aspects of the Clean Air Act, but, you know, I was just referring to these coal-fired plants, and I don't know, do you have any of those?
We have a lot of those in Illinois, so right on our border.
Yeah, so you're getting this then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people there are no doubt showing up at hospitals or even dying from these problems. And these are preventable problems. 90% of those fine particulates can be taken out with existing technology that's not too expensive, that's in fact been put on some plants. It's just unconscionable, really, that it's not being enforced. This is something that goes back almost 30 years, you know, to those 77 amendments. And the idea was certainly not, and Congress did not intend to allow 30 more years of pollution. Or if this proposal goes through, this is one thing that's going to come up in Bush's second term. The new source review proposal I was referring to that would allow some 95% of these plants to just keep on doing what they're doing. If that goes through, this is going to go on for many years to come. They can cobble together fixes for these old plants for maybe decades before they finally run out of steam, so to speak.
I'm also troubled by reports that I am seeing that not only are they going after the Clean Air Act, not only are they going after changing a number of policies, but I'm reading also that they're even going after the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah, that's been a target of many of the conservatives for a long time because of the fact that it can get in the way of development or logging or oil and gas exploration. It gets in the way of many economic activities by certain major players. Now, they can certainly do what they want to do in some way. It's not like it actually brings it to a halt. I shouldn't have put it that way. What it does is makes it a little less profitable for them. They have to leave certain areas or make allowances in certain ways. It's a bother. It has a lot of permits attached to it. And so they would love to see that basically gone. And what they've been doing, this gets to a very important point. When I mentioned at near the top of the hour that there are these almost secretive methods. Often they're not secretive truly, but they're just obscure. And most people will never know about them, that are always being used. Just little administrative tweaks. And this is a good example where they're trying to starve the Endangered Species Act because it's a very popular act, certainly among the public, including Republicans, including the people who voted for Bush. Their studies have shown they're overwhelmingly in support of, well, the environment in general, but the Endangered Species Act in particular. So they don't want to tackle it head on. But one of the things they're doing is just starving the budget and the budget for examining species to be put on the list or
enforcement
or always enforcement or listing critical habitat, and they're taking away a lot of money, and I believe as of a few months ago anyway, I'm not quite sure now, but I assume it's the same, they have not listed any new species in the 4 years they've been there, except in a few cases where it already was almost a done deal when they came into office.
So everybody,
they're under court order.
So would this be the first administration in the history of administrations that have listed endangered species that nothing got on the list during their reign?
I'm pretty sure it is. I can't say absolutely, but I'm almost sure that's true.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, there are hundreds of things on the list, so you can imagine over the 30-some years it's existed, that means many are listed every year as a rule, dozens and dozens.
Well, with the environment, the report just came out today that this is the hottest year on record since we've been keeping, and the past 4 years have been the hottest on record since we've been keeping records. That can't help some species out there. So I can't see how there's nothing that ended up on the endangered species list in the last 4 years.
No, I mean, there are hundreds of plants and animals on the candidate list, they call it, that are waiting in the wings that scientists believe deserve endangered status but have not yet been examined. And again, that's where the lack of money hurts, because it takes money to do the research.
To make that decision.
And that's not been done.
And we have about 3 more minutes here, Robert. Can we get to the ocean right quick? Where are we in the status of the protection of our oceans under this current administration?
Well, I don't know a lot about that, to be honest. I know there was a high-level commission appointed to look at it, and I've heard that they came up with some fairly strong recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that those have been anything but recommendations at this point.
Okay, let me take a quick call here. You have a question for our guest.
Yes, I may have missed this, but maybe if I haven't, your guest can answer it. What is causing the dolphins in huge amounts, not constantly maybe, but you hear of this in other kinds of talk shows, hundreds and hundreds beaching themselves and dying like they're committing suicide, and also whales?
Thanks.
I don't know whether your guest has even heard of this, but I have.
Right.
I certainly heard of it. I don't have expertise in it, but I think it's something that actually is poorly understood. I don't think there's a definitive answer to that. Some people think it may be sonar from Navy ships, but I can't give you a definitive answer, and I'm fairly sure there is not one. It's still a mystery.
And let me end with this, Robert. When you wrote your book, Bush versus the Environment, was there anything that you discovered in the writing of the book that surprised you, that you really didn't see coming?
There were a number of things,
okay.
And I know we don't have time to go through them all, but I'll mention one that I knew was going on a little bit, but I was really taken aback by the extent of it, and that is their misuse of science. Far more than any other administration, they have been very dishonest, frankly, in how they have presented scientific knowledge. They've bullied agency scientists who don't give them the results they want. They've actually altered reports. They've buried information that doesn't suit their political ends, and the scientific community has been in an uproar about this. More than 5,000 of them have signed on to a very critical letter.
5,000.
Yeah, more. It's 5,300 and counting right now.
Mm.
A huge number.
Yes, it is.
And it's almost unanimous. In fact, as far as I know, it is unanimous. The only people defending the administration's scientific abuses has been the people in the administration itself.
Mm.
And I think that's very surprising that they would be that heavy-handed and that contemptuous of science, especially when they frequently talk about the importance of sound science. It's one of their favorite sayings, but absolutely not the way they operate.
Mm. One more. Let me take this call from San Francisco. Yes, you're on the air. You have a question for our guest?
Yeah, morning, Liz.
Good morning.
I've forgotten your guest's name. But
Robert Devine.
Oh, great, yeah. You know, I heard you talking about Alaska and the oil drilling, and then as well, one of the real reasons for not drilling up there is because the polar ice caps are melting, and that when we start putting pollution up there, it creates ash, it creates hot water up in there, and it creates the ability for the polar ice cap to melt. So, for example, there are nuclear power plants in the Soviet Union. They've got a couple of rivers that flow north straight into the Arctic Circle. The pollution up in the northernmost part of Alaska coming from the oil drilling up there is profound. It's created so much ash and dirt along the surface of just along the top of the snow. It forces the snow to melt, and then all of those toxics create a dead zone, which create further gases that melt the polar ice cap. And then I was talking to one of the energy officials up in Canada not too long ago, and they're all set to build more nuclear or facilitate the redevelopment of some nuclear power plants on the east coast of Canada. And if they do that, that's going to also create hot water discharges into the ocean, and that will flow up north toward the polar ice cap. So all of this energy development toward the north part of the globe is really developing that. And then just as you were talking about the dolphins and the beachings of the whales, I don't know if you're aware of the Navy's, you mentioned a sonar program, but it's not really sonar so much as it's just enormous sound wave blastings that are, it's supposed to be a method for submarines to communicate with each other, but it's an enormous sound blast that's the equivalent of something like 1,500 jets taking off at once, and they essentially want to have submarines communicate with each other with a noise that's so loud that it can be heard on the other side of the earth.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Sure.
Okay. And Robert, I want you to have the final word in terms of your visit here with us on the Wake Up Call. Where can people get a copy of your book?
It should be in any bookstore. It's widely available. So.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, Robert Devine, for joining us here on the Wake Up Call.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Yeah, to you too.
All right. Listen, folks, we're going to take a break. My name is Liz Brown. This is the Wake Up Call. We need to do this, and then we'll get back to you. So get to us at 454-0400, 1-877-920-WGNU. I'll be back. Stay with me.
You're listening to the Best of the Wake Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU. We'll be back with more of the Best of the Wake Up Call following these messages.
Tennessee. The first bus is filling up for the big live recording session with Lee Williams and the Spiritual QCs. Saturday night, June 2nd, we will stay over for the Sunday morning worship service. Both services are held at the Temple of Deliverance in Memphis. On the way back, we will stop for dinner at Lambert's. You don't want to miss this trip. To reserve your seat, call Erico 314-381-7228. That's 381-7228. Yes, we're going to have a mighty good time. Don't miss it.
Connect Care, still connected to the community. Sometimes it seems like things are changing so fast that it's hard to keep up and hard to keep track. At Connect Care, we want you to know that yes, there have been some changes, and yes, we are still connected to the community. At Connect Care, we still have a retail pharmacy open 8 to 5 Monday through Friday. At Connect Care, we still provide transportation to patients that qualify. At Connect Care, we still provide access to in-house laboratory services. At Connect Care, we still provide some of the region's best board-certified doctors. At Connect Care, we still provide urgent care. And at Connect Care, we still see patients on a sliding fee scale. Yes, changes have been made at Connect Care, but we're still connected to you. Connect Care, still connected to the community.
The Webster University film series continues with Raiders of the Lost Ark, the adaptation, on Friday at 9 p.m. This movie showcases three kids from Mississippi as they set out to create a shot-for-shot remake of the original film. Admission is $4 to $6 per person. Find out more by visiting webster.edu. Movie news to you from AM 920.
Hello, I'm John Womack. I have a new show on WGNU called On the Table. Some of the things we'll talk about will be restaurants, food and wine trends, recipes, but really, we're just trying to help you experience great food and wine, whether you're at home or out on the town. So if you love great food and wine, you'll love On the Table. Be listening every Tuesday at noon here on WGNU.
Starting your day with information you can't get anywhere else. It's the award-winning Wake Up Call with Liz Brown.
Understand, this is for all of my ancestors who were raped, who were killed, and hung because of their plight for freedom and for dignity. They died for me, and they died for you. This is for them to know that, yes, we are still fired up, and we're still talking about revolution.
Every one of you, my dear brother, when you go home, here's what I want you to do. We must belong to some organization that is working for and in the interest of the uplift and the liberation of our people. Go back. Join the NAACP if you want to. Join the Urban League. Join the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Join us. Join the Nation of Islam. Join PUSH. Join the Congress of Racial Equality. Join SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. But we must become a totally organized people. And the only way we can do that is to become a part of some organization that is working for the uplift of our people. We must keep the local organizing committees that made this event possible. We must keep them together. Go back and join the local organizing committee. And then all of us as leaders must stay together and make the National African American Leadership Summit inclusive of all of us. Now, many of the people that's in this house right here are put there by the margins of the black vote. So, in the next election, we want to see who in here do we want to stay? And who in here do we want to go? And we want to show them that never again will they ever disrespect the black community. We must make them afraid to do evil to us and think they can get away with it. We must be prepared to help them if they're with us, or to punish them if they're against us. And when they're against us, I'm not talking about color. I'm talking about an agenda that's in the best interest of the black, the poor, and the vulnerable in this society.
I'm hearing revolution in the air.
We will have more of the best of the Wake Up Call after the top of the hour news, the traffic, and the weather. This is AM 920 WGNU.
Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Well,
very sad news for all of you, the people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. You pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below me.
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it. A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment.
And so we say to all in this nation who would dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
For the issues that matter most, it's AM 920 WGNU, Granite City, St. Louis.
Here's the latest from ABC News. I'm Daria Albinger. Marches, meetings, and voter registration drives are planned today from California to New York as immigrants take to the streets to bring attention to their cause. They want a new legal path to citizenship, if possible, before the presidential primaries.
About 100,000 people are expected to clog the streets here in downtown Los Angeles. A lot of businesses have vowed to shut down, and students are being urged to please stay in school.
ABC's Elsa Ramon in Los Angeles. It was 4 years ago today.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
But that wasn't the case today. The president gets a progress report on the war in a visit to CENTCOM. He's also getting the bill Congress passed last week to fund the war if the troops start to come home this fall.
4 years later, Democrats say the Iraq mission certainly has not been accomplished. And they plan a send-off for the war funding bill with a timetable for troop withdrawal, which the president promises to veto. Mr. Bush has invited leaders in both parties to the White House tomorrow to talk about a new bill to replace the one that he plans to reject.
ABC's Vic Ratner at the Capitol. If you filled your car lately, you know that gas prices are up, and they're up by a lot. ABC News national correspondent Jim Hickey has the story.
When you pull up to the pump, what do you feel?
I get disgruntled when I go to the gas station.
Get ready to feel even more disgruntled. The average pump price, says the government, is now only 10 cents from an all-time high.
It's just ridiculous. I don't see what the reason is.
The reason, we are told by the experts, is the country's stockpile of gasoline is worrisome, below the 5-year average for this time of year. Some analysts say a $4 gallon of gas is within reach this summer. Jim Hickey, ABC News.
And the worst part, we're not even into the busy summer driving season. That's still a few weeks away. This is ABC News.
If you're living in a space that's too small or too large or too old or just too ugly, here's what you do. Take a 2x4 to the problem. Maybe some 2x6s. Heck, just take all your lumber and give it to a member of the American Institute of Architects. We'll design a home that fits your needs and your budget to a T. Call an AIA architect early, so your living space won't be too this or too that, but just right. AIA. Good design makes a difference. Visit AIA.org.
If your car or truck is ready for new tires before your wallet is, hurry to your Ford or Lincoln Mercury dealership. Buy tires now and pay later with our genuine service credit card. Plus, bring in any competitor's current price ad on the name brand tires we sell within 30 days of purchase, and we'll beat that price, guaranteed. New tires, installed by Ford-trained experts. Buy now and pay later. See your Ford or Lincoln Mercury dealership for details today. Offer ends June 30th.
And now, you probably wouldn't think twice about college students doing this kind of thing, except for the fact that these students are graduating from a conservative Christian school. Here's ABC's Daniela Bellata.
They didn't wear hats or gowns. In fact, they didn't wear much of anything. About 200 Concordia College students stripped off their inhibitions and their clothing and went skinny dipping in a murky pond on campus. A security officer tried to shoo them out. Instead, a few of them pushed his golf cart into the pond. He then called in reinforcements. When police arrived, the students in various states of undress fled, but in their haste to get away, 10 left behind their wallets. No one's been arrested, but charges may be coming. Daniela Bellata, ABC News.
All right, admit it. You've exaggerated a little on your resume. All right, fine, but out-and-out lies are a big no-no. The outplacement firm Challenger Grand Christmas says there are areas that prospective employers really look at in their education job titles and previous salaries. One fib, you probably won't get the job. I'm Daria Albinger, ABC News.
Now, the local report from the WGNU Newsroom.
Good morning, St. Louis. This is Patrick Brandmeier with your WGNU news update for the 7 o'clock hour. In the news this Tuesday, an invitation for Senator Claire McCaskill to speak at a high school commencement ceremony has been rescinded. McCaskill had been invited to the ceremony, but shortly afterwards was called again and told that she would not be able to give the commencement speech at St. Joseph's Academy. Officials with McCaskill's camp and officials with the Catholic Archdiocese of St. Louis say she was uninvited because she is pro-choice and a proponent of embryonic stem cell research. A mother and son are safe after their house exploded yesterday afternoon. The blast charred part of the home on South 37th Street in Belleville around 1 o'clock. The family got out of the home just minutes before the explosion occurred. The fire was hot enough to partially melt the siding on a nearby house. No one was hurt in the incident. Finally this hour, the Cardinals were shut down by Jeff Suppan for the second time this year as they lost to the Brewers 7-1 last night in Milwaukee. It was the team's first game since the death of relief pitcher Josh Hancock after a traffic accident on Sunday. Former Cardinal Suppan pitched a complete game, allowing only one run on 8 hits. Kip Wells struggled for the Redbirds, giving up 7 runs on 6 hits in 6 innings for his 4th consecutive loss. That's your look at local news for the 7 o'clock hour. I'm Patrick Brandmeier, bringing you the news that matters most to you.
Good morning, St. Louis. 6 minutes after the hour of 7 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton. Let's take a look at your traffic and weather for your 7 o'clock hour. Northbound 270 at 55 through Tesson Ferry. Look for an accident. And you can expect stop traffic. It's also blocking 2 lanes southbound, so look for some delays. Northbound 270 at Dorset through 70, look for stop-and-go traffic in the 70 exit lanes. Southbound 270 from St. Charles Rock Road through 70, there's an accident. Left lane's blocked. That's south of 70. And left lane of northbound is blocked as well. There's a whole lot of problems on 270 already this morning. Northbound 55 between Butler Hill and 270. Look for stop-and-go traffic. Do that 270 accident is causing a lot of delays, so give yourself plenty of time and expect to be late to work this morning. Eastbound 40 between Maryville Center and Mason Road. Heavy volume going on there. Southbound 170 from St. Charles Rock Road through Del Mar. Look for heavy volume there as well. Northbound 55 from 3200 South Broadway into 44, look for some slowdowns. And northbound 270 from Graboy through Big Bend, you've got delays going on there. Eastbound 70 from Bryan Road through 79, slow traffic going on. Eastbound 70 from east or just west of the Earth City Expressway through 270, look for some slowdowns there as well. And westbound 5570 on the Poplar Street Bridge, look for some delays. And westbound 5570 from 3rd Street into the Poplar Street Bridge. Look for some slowdowns there as well. Westbound Bowell Avenue, or 5570, actually, westbound 64 from Bowell Avenue into the 5570 split. Look for a lot of delays there as well. You can expect some slowdowns. Northbound Route 3, that approach onto the Poplar Street Bridge, it is stopped at this hour. And westbound Kingbridge traffic is moving well from mid-span on into downtown. That is a look at your traffic. Now let's take a look at your forecast for today, tomorrow, and for Thursday. for today. Look forward to partly sunny skies this morning, mostly cloudy throughout the day. Chance of showers with a high in the mid-80s. This evening, showers and thunderstorms likely, low around 60. Wednesday, cooler, showers and thunderstorms likely, low in the lower 70s. Wednesday evening, showers and thunderstorms continue, low in the upper 50s. And Thursday, showers and thunderstorms likely with a high in the lower 70s. Currently at the studios of AM 920 WGNU, we have 71 degrees. Lambert Fields reporting 73, both under overcast skies. Liz Brown is not in today. We will bring you more of the best of the wake-up call. She will be in live tomorrow at 6 a.m. Until then, enjoy this best of the wake-up call. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU. We'll take another look at your traffic and weather in the bottom of the 7 o'clock hour. This is AM 920 WGNU, your station for the issues that matter most to you.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air.
Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Some very sad news for all of you, the people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
Say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. You pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below me.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brother, how can this
stand? But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it. A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment.
And so we say to all in this nation who dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
Now we bring you more of the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
This is Mondays at 9 with Liz Brown, where we take a closer look at issues and people shaping our world and how they affect us. Once again, here's Liz Brown.
Welcome, welcome to Mondays at 9. This is, of course, Liz Brown, living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number, 454-6609. Is my fax, and if you want to toll free long distance me, you can do that at 1-877-920-WGNU. That's 1-877-920-WGNU. Any kind of, every kind of, all kinds of ways you need to get up, you need to get to me. This Monday's at 9. We will be talking to one of the producers, directors of the documentary The Lost Boys of Sudan, John Schneck, joining us from San Francisco. And we hopefully will have Peter Dute, one of the orphans of the Sudan, who made the journey to America. As many of you know, in August, I traveled to the Sudan to find out about what was going on in Sudan. So I am looking, very much looking forward to talking to Peter Dute about that. But first, let me get to John Schneck, one of the producers and directors of the documentary The Lost Boys of Sudan, joining us from San Francisco. John, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. John, The Lost Boys of Sudan. Can you give us a synopsis of what led you to make this movie?
Sure. In early, in the year 2001, Megan Mylan and I started reading about this incredible story that was happening, where the U.S. refugee program had endeavored to bring about 4,000 quote-unquote lost boys of Sudan who were orphans from the ongoing civil war in Sudan living in a refugee camp in Kenya to the United States as part of the U.S. refugee program. And essentially they were doing what the refugee program does every year, but with a very unusual group of refugees. These lost boys who were orphaned in the late 1980s during extreme flare-ups in the war there had been living in a refugee camp for many, many years and essentially had grown up, and they are now teenagers and young men and without families. And the reason they were classified as refugees with high priority to be resettled is that really very few of them had any family left. Their families had been killed in the war, and they literally had been orphaned and left to wander around the desert. And the UN had taken them to refugee camps, but they were still had very unstable lives. And so we heard about this story through some newspaper accounts, and it just felt like an incredible opportunity to follow what was clearly just an incredible human drama, and also a story that would allow us to really take an in-depth look at all kinds of issues that range from, you know, obviously raising awareness of the civil war in Sudan, but also watching an outsider look at America through completely different eyes than we're used to looking at it. And so we really jumped on the story right away, and very quickly we started the film.
Now, in your research, you discovered that there were about 3,800 Sudanese children that were brought here to the United States.
Yeah, well, at that time, several hundred had. You know, when we first heard about the story, there had been several hundred, maybe up to about 1,000, who had been resettled,
mm-hmm.
and we knew that there was going to be, you know, many more, because they had, like you said, they had identified about 3,800 lost boys and very few girls to come over.
And why is that? Why was there such a difficult time in locating young girls to bring over?
Well, it's a complicated story that actually starts with the battles that orphaned these guys originally in the late 80s in Sudan. Most of these guys are from the Dinka tribe, which is a cattle herding culture in Africa.
And what is their religious affiliation? Do you know?
Mostly Christian.
Okay.
Mostly Christian and animist. And the part of the culture that these guys are from is that the young boys often go live in cattle camps to take care of the herds. And they live away from their families. And so when the soldiers would arrive in these villages, often they would kill the families, and the boys would come back at a later time and find that they were alone. And that's why, to begin with, there were few girls, because the girls either ran with their families or were killed with their families, and the boys were then orphans.
And when we talk about the boys, we're talking about just that, boys. Where were the fathers? Where were the men of the villages?
Well, the men were either fighting in the war, mm-hmm. you know, part of the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, or they were killed by the northern soldiers who came into these towns, or they were running away because they knew that they could be either conscripted or targeted. Okay. And so there was a lot of factors conspiring against members of the community in these villages. And the boys, just kind of through sheer luck about by the way that they happened to live their lives, were often saved because they were away taking care of the farms and the cattle when a lot of these battles occurred.
So how did our government, or the UN, I'm sorry, make the decision of where the young boys were going to be, or where the boys were going to be placed? What states were targeted and why?
Well, what happens is the U.S. refugee program looks around the world every year at some 14 to 15 million refugees that live in the world at any given time, and they essentially ask themselves who deserves to be resettled the most. And obviously, it's a terrible question to ask.
It's an awful question,
because only about 40,000 to 50,000 people get resettled of those millions and millions of people in the United States. And the United States has by far the largest refugee program of any country in the world. So really, very percentage-wise, it's very few people. And essentially they ask, well, who is in most danger of returning home? Who is truly somebody who cannot return home without fear of death or fear of infliction of some kind of pain, and they go and they do thorough interview processes.
Do they also consider what an individual has to return home to?
Sure. I mean, they say, okay, here's a group of teenage boys. If they were to go home to Sudan, what would happen to them? Well, for number one, there's a war going on there, so mm-hmm. the danger is just as great as it was today as it was 20 years ago. B, do they have any family to go home to? And that question in particular with the Lost Boys was just a very stark answer, no. I mean, they really did not have anybody left in their hometowns.
So they made the decision based upon those factors. What's the next decision-making factor?
So the next decision is where are these guys going to be resettled? And you had asked, you know, how does that work? And the State Department of the U.S. government actually works with about 10 resettlement agencies in the United States that actually are contracted by the government to do the social work of getting these guys settled into their new homes. And these agencies are all over the country.
And what factors do they look at, John, to decide, okay, we're going to take this group of Cambodian refugees and we're going to settle them here. We're going to take this group of Bosnian refugees and settle them here. We're going to take this group of African, black African Sudanese and settle them over here. What are some of the factors that they look at?
Well, I mean, when there's a number of factors. Some part of it is just a numbers game. I mean, you know, if you're the Catholic Charities Organization in St. Louis or in San Jose, California, or one of these places, you go to a meeting every week and you say, okay, we have 20 spots in homes and apartments that we have in our city, so we can take those people. And then it's also a matter of trying to match people with cousins and friends and family who might live in cities already in the United States. So it's kind of a complicated, sort of matching game that the agencies play every week to try to get these people resettled all over the country. And they do get resettled in a number of different places. And most states in the union have Lost Boys living in them. And all states in the union obviously have refugees living there.
So do you have any idea of where the largest number of these young men that came from Sudan, where they're being resettled?
Oh, yeah.
Because
I mean,
in St. Louis we have thousands and thousands and thousands of Bosnians that have been resettled
uh-huh.
here in St. Louis. Were there that large a group of the Sudanese boys that were settled in one place? Or?
No, I mean, there were only, you know, about 4,000 total Lost mm-hmm. Boys who came over to the
okay.
U.S. It was a large group, but it wasn't thousands and it wasn't endless.
Okay.
And so the most the city has, a place like Phoenix has about 160.
Mm-hmm.
Atlanta, Georgia, Chicago, San Diego, California, Fargo, North Dakota, Boston has several. They range from, some cities like Burlington, Vermont might have a dozen. Phoenix has over 100. So it's a range, but generally they're placed in cities, with other small groups in group homes. There were a number of lost boys who were under the age of 18, and that qualified them to live in foster care situations, where in places like Grand Rapids, Michigan, and smaller towns where families would actually take these guys in, and they would live in homes with people and go to school.
And what's the age range of these young men when they were brought here to the United States, the oldest to the youngest?
They range. I mean, one kind of interesting thing about this group is they don't know their exact ages. They were kind of arbitrarily given ages when they arrived at the refugee camp in Africa, but they range in age from, I'd say, about 15 to 23 or 24, and the younger kids would be placed in school, and then the older ones would really be essentially given an apartment for a couple of months and given a, sort of help to find a low-paying job, and they were really on their own very quickly, as you see in the film. It's just incredibly difficult almost from the very beginning for these guys.
And also that there was a problem with the arbitrary decision of how old these young men were.
These guys are an incredible story of redemption. I mean, they have been living in this refugee camp in Kenya, which you have to picture as just this not a particularly pleasant place to live, where there's local strife, there's tribal strife. It's a very large camp. And they had been going to school there. They had been essentially saw themselves as students. Their elders in the camp, a few of them that did survive, had really kind of beaten into them the sense of, you must get educated. This is your only way that you're going to make your way out of this situation. And they had really taken that to heart. And they're strong believers in education. And, they get over here and they realize it's not going to be easy. They have to, work these $6-7 an hour jobs at night, and then without knowing the language at first, they had to, make their way and to figure out the incredibly complicated logistics of even finding a school, and then much less finding the money and the scholarships and all that kind of thing to get in. So it's very difficult.
And then even the mystery of their ages, because if they were a certain age, then they could go to school.
Exactly. I'm sorry. Yeah. I mean, they saw themselves as school age, and then this arbitrary idea that, when you come to this country when you're under 18, okay, you go to high school, but if you're over 18, which a great deal of them were, then they did not have that opportunity given to them. They had to really work hard for it. And by now, fast forward several years, a number of them are in community colleges and in universities. So there is starting to be a silver lining to the story. But for years and years, these guys struggled were kind of incredible sort of cold glass of water in the face to them, because they really thought they were coming to the U.S. for education.
So, and the other piece of it is not simply the fact that they thought they were coming here for education, and then all of the extraordinary, sometimes arbitrary, often arbitrary roadblocks that were put up to keep them from education. There's culture shock as well. Everything from the weather to race to economic differences. They had to, and then the language barriers as well.
Yeah, I mean, you have to imagine. I mean, it sounds like some kind of crazy cliche, but there is truth in the fact that they literally kind of step out of, one day they're living literally in mud huts in Africa. No electricity, no plumbing, very little access to the outside world, very little sense of modernity at all. And they get on a 747.
But they're also living with African people that look like them as well.
Yeah, they're living essentially kind of in a version of what their villages in Sudan would look like, which they replicated in these camps, mm-hmm. living with, many people around them and going to school and going about essentially kind of a tribal life.
Mm-hmm. And again, everywhere they look, for the most part, they see people that look like them.
Exactly.
As well.
Exactly. Okay. I mean, they go from living with either extended family or friends that they had been living with since the trauma of being separated from their family. And they end up in the case in the story that we follow fellow in Houston, Texas, essentially kind of in a, you know, in kind of not so great part of town of Houston, Texas, and they're put in these apartments, you know, where three or four or five people of them live together, and they're just, they suddenly find themselves faced with what just seems like a endless jigsaw puzzle of logistical problems, you know, from everything from turning on the stove and figuring out how, you know, things in the home work to trying to get to jobs that are sometimes 2 or 3 hours from their home by public transportation.
And we're going to have to let that be a stopping point, John. We've got to take a break here. And when we come back, I'd like to continue that, as well as get to the conversation of picking the two young men that you picked to represent the Lost Boys of Sudan. I'm talking to one of the producers, directors of the documentary, The Lost Boys of Sudan, John Schneck, who is joining us from San Francisco. My name is Liz Brown. This is Mondays at 9. We need to take a traffic break. I'll be right with you shortly. Stay with us.
You're listening to the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU. Good morning, St. Louis. 30 minutes after the hour of 7 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton. Let's take a look at this hour's traffic and weather. Northbound 270 at 55 and Tesson Ferry. Look for stop traffic. Northbound 55 between Merrimack Bottom and 270. Look for stop and go traffic due to a 270 accident. Westbound 270 at Old Halls Ferry and Graham Hanley. You've got stop and go traffic going on there. Eastbound 40 from Maryville Center through Mason Road. Look for stop and go traffic. There's an accident right lane that's near Mason. Look for some delays there. Northbound 270 Dorset through 70. Look for stop and go traffic in the 70 exit lanes. Southbound 270 from St. Charles Rock Road through 70. Look for stop and go traffic due to an accident. Left lane's blocked as south of 70, and the left lane of northbound is also blocked as well. Westbound 5570 from 3rd Street into the Poplar Street Bridge. Look for no go there. Westbound 64 from Bow Avenue into the 5570 merge. Look for stop and go traffic as well. Westbound Kingbridge traffic is not moving very well from the gravel pit into the landing. And northbound 270 between Gravois and Big Bend, look for slow traffic. Southbound 170 from St. Charles Rock Road through Del Mar, look for some delays there. Northbound 55 from 3200 South Broadway into 44, it is slow. And eastbound 70 between Bryan Road and 79, look for some delays as well. That is a look at your traffic. Now let's take a look at your forecast for today, tomorrow, and for Thursday. For today, look forward to partly sunny skies this morning, otherwise mostly cloudy today. Chance of showers and thunderstorms with a high in the mid-80s. For this evening, showers and thunderstorms likely, low around 60. For Wednesday, cooler, showers and thunderstorms, a high in the lower 70s. Wednesday evening, showers and thunderstorms with a low in the upper 50s. And Thursday, you guessed it, showers and thunderstorms with a high in the lower 70s. Currently at the studios of AM 920 WGNU, we have 71 degrees under overcast skies. Lambert Fields reporting the same. Liz Brown is out today. She will be back tomorrow morning beginning at 6 a.m. Until then, more of the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU, your station for the issues that matter most to you.
Red Defender! That huge asteroid is headed towards Earth!
I'll handle this.
The Red Defender hurtles towards the asteroid!
You saved us! How?
I stopped the asteroid and reversed it back into space.
The moon! It's exploded!
Where did you throw that asteroid?
Away.
Saving the world isn't easy. Saving a life is. One pint of blood can save up to 3 lives. Go to bloodsave.com. A public service message brought to you by the Ad Council.
Praise the Lord, everyone. This is the Elder Mitchell Thornton of the All Request Sweet Sounds of Music. We bring you the best gospel sounds in St. Louis, as well as the up-to-date church news to help you plan your weekend worship every Saturday morning from 7:30 a.m. to 8 a.m. right here on WGNU 920 on your radio dial.
Investing during these turbulent times can be anything but a thrilling roller coaster ride of ups and downs. What is it that makes some investors thrive in turbulent times while others hope to just survive? Heartland Financial Security Group is presenting the first It's Your Money seminar, sponsored in part by AM 920 WGNU, Thursday evening, May the 3rd at 6:30. Learn about the by-the-numbers approach to investing at the Holiday Inn Southwest and Viking Conference Center located at 10709 Watson Road. Space is limited, so reservations will be required. To reserve your seat for the It's Your Money seminar, call 314-512-8888 today. Start planning now to manage your investments at the It's Your Money seminar, brought to you by Heartland Financial Security Group and AM 920 WGNU. Call now to reserve your seat, 314-512-8888, 314-512-8888. Securities offered through Securities America Incorporated, member NASD SIPC. Heartland Financial Security Group and Securities America are independent entities.
Are you one of those people who look at somebody who's big boned and think that's just a euphemism for Twinkie enriched? Are you sick of the idea that we can go to war in Serbia and bomb the crud out of them, but we should stay out of Iraq? If the whole entire pop culture thing, Britney Spears, Super Bowl commercials, and all that stuff gets on your nerves, well, guess what? It gets on mine, too. So if you want someone to listen and understand, listen to me, Brett Rosen, every Tuesday, 10 a.m. on WGNU, 920 a.m.
Informative, educational, provocative. This is the award-winning Morning Wake-Up Call with Liz Brown.
Liz Brown is out today. Instead, we bring you the best of the Wake-Up Call, so stick around for more. Up next, we'll take another look at your news, traffic, and weather in the 8 o'clock hour. This is AM 920 WGNU.
Well, I'm sweet, while shepherds watch a keeping. This is Christ the King, whom shepherds love.
This is Mondays at 9 with Liz Brown, where we take a closer look at issues and people shaping our world. Once again, here's Liz Brown.
Welcome back. I'm talking to John Schneck, the one of the producers directors of the documentary The Lost Boys of Sudan, joining us from San Francisco. John, welcome back.
Thank you.
When we went out on our break, you were talking about where the two young men from your documentary ended up being placed and some of the culture shock that they were going through when they were placed there.
Right. Yes. The culture shock had really two stages. There was an initial kind of almost comical aspect to it, and when I say comical, it was comical both to watch, but it's also, it was sort of funny to them. I mean, they one kind of thing that people say and realize about these guys when you first meet them is that they're just incredible people. They have very warm, open hearts. They go about life in this very charming, kind of amused way, and they're really not afraid of sort of laughing at their own situation and making light of what is, I think for many people, just an incredibly painful situation where they're really faced with a large version of what we all face when we leave home and face a foreign place, which is, you know, how do you just go about your day? How do you eat? How do you live? How do you get to work? How do you communicate? How do you use this thing called a telephone?
And who do you talk to?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you bring up an incredibly important point, which is when Megan and I first started thinking about this idea, we kind of imagined filming conversations eventually between the Lost Boys and native-born Americans that they would meet once they arrived here. And it really did not happen so quickly. It was incredible to us that these guys arrived on our shores and were soon working in our factories and going to our schools, and almost had this sort of of invisible quality. People did not approach them on the street and very rarely talked to them. And
were you surprised by that?
We were surprised by it. And we had one incredibly poignant day with Santino, one of our characters, who is just a lovely person and we came to really grow close to. And one day he turned to us, this was about 6 months into filming, and he said, you know, I have two American friends. We said, oh, great, you know, who are they? We want to film you with them, we want to meet them, we want to talk to them. He said, well, actually, they're you guys. They're you and Megan and John. And we just wanted to cry. We thought, you know, after 6 months, we were the only people that were checking in on him daily. He felt like we were the only ones that were kind of true Americans who were, you know, born and raised here who cared about their story. I was just going to say, that just, you know, while we were proud to be part of his life like that, we were also incredibly saddened by that.
So tell us about the two characters that make up the Lost Boys of Sudan.
Well, we decided in the refugee camp, when we were filming there in the refugee camp, we decided to film a couple of young men, and one of them is named Santino Chuar, and the other is named Peter Condut.
And those are their names. Those are their African names.
Yeah, I mean, these guys have what they call their Christian names, which are Santino and Peter, and what they call their Dinka names. Santino's name is Majok, so his name is Santino Majok Chuar, and Peter's Dinka name is actually Dang, Peter Dang Dut. And most in American kind of situations at school and at work, they think it's easier to be called by Santino and Peter, so that's what we've sort of referred to them as in the film.
Mm-hmm.
But we had an opportunity when we were over there filming to meet about 100 or so of the Lost Boys who were coming over on the flight that we had been scheduled to return on to the United States. And we raced around this camp in our four-wheel drive vehicle with the help of the UN and met a number of these guys. And there was just something about Santino and Peter when we met them. Peter, as you see in the film, he's got a very kind of intense look about him. He's obviously has kind of a go-getter attitude, and we just liked him right away. He seemed very curious about who we were and what we were doing. Santino was very different. He was very philosophical. He's almost has sort of a artist or a philosopher's kind of personality. He's very gentle. He looked at me in the eye and he told me that someday he wanted to come to California and learn the ways of my tribe.
Mm.
And I just felt like this is this is somebody that I really could see spending a great deal of time with. And that was really kind of the basic question that we had to ask ourselves is, you know, essentially we were kind of shopping, so to speak, for not only for somebody who would be a character in our film, but for a friend and eventually a family member, because we became very close to these guys.
Did you know what kind of story that you wanted to tell when you prior to your meeting Peter and Santino? And was that the story that was ended up told?
Yeah, I mean, we have. Of course, you always. I mean, whenever you make do any kind of nonfiction storytelling, you go into it with a certain set of preconceptions, and you're almost begging for those things to be replaced by the actual reality of the situation. And there were certain things that came true, and there were others that weren't. I mean, we really felt like, kind of from a Western point of view, that we really felt like we were going to be filming a lot of psychological problems. We kind of envisioned a post-traumatic stress story where these guys had been escaped from a war and we're going to still be dealing with it. And we found that really not to be the case. They had really, it had been many years since the...
It was about 10 years or so that they had spent in the...
Exactly. They had been in this camp for 10 years. And they really had, through the almost sheer willpower and through kind of peer-to-peer support, which they provided for each other, proven to themselves and to the world that there is an alternative way of dealing with... the horrors of war, and we learned a lot from them in this way, and that they just simply support each other no matter what, and they are there for each other as brothers, and it's really an incredible thing to watch, and they're very physical with each other. with touching and hugging and.
Well, when I was in Sudan over the summer, and I was also in Ghana, and one of the things that I saw exchange between the African men, I saw them holding hands.
Yeah, exactly.
That they are very comfortable with affection and being close to other people.
Yeah, it's a lesson we could all learn, and you see them actually when they get to the States very quickly they learn that it's not quote unquote cool to hold hands with other men,
mm-hmm.
and they talk about how they have this really kind of amusing conversation that they're kind of laughing at along with the viewer in the film about how if you hold hands that means you're gay in America and you can't do that in public, and one of the guys says no, I'm going to still do it no matter what because I feel proud to be African. And it's very interesting to watch them kind of debate among themselves what is appropriate in American culture and then what they want to hold on to from their tradition, because that's an important important aspect of their lives.
Now, you could have told the story of the journey from Sudan to Kenya. That could have been a documentary.
I mean, that could be a whole historical documentary unto itself. And we do, in the first few minutes of the film, try to give just the basics of the information about the war. I mean, what is going on in Sudan and continues to go on in Sudan to this day is an abomination, a civil war that, knows no boundaries, is both economic, it has a religious component, there's a racial component. It's really just an awful situation over there.
Well, in terms of the journey from Sudan to Kenya, that was about 1,000 miles or so.
Yeah, there's conflicting accounts. Depending on where one happened to be living during the flare-ups in the Civil War, sometimes these guys traveled for hundreds and hundreds of miles, as you say, sometimes less. But they had to, once they were abandoned and once they were orphaned, they still were not out of danger. They had to kind of bound together, and they became a group, a legion of about 20,000 young kids. And they made their way across the border to Ethiopia, where there was relative peace, and that's where they first settled in a first refugee camp. But then, to make the story just even more incredible, the Ethiopian government had a change.
Haile Selassie passed.
Exactly, mm-hmm. And they had their own kind of civil war going on, and these guys were kicked out of Ethiopia, and they had to cross a river full of crocodiles with soldiers firing on them from one side back into Sudan, to where there were soldiers waiting to kidnap and hurt them again. And they had to make their way back into Sudan to the southern border with Kenya, where there was peace at the time. And the UN helped them get across the border into another refugee camp. So these guys you hear them tell this tale, and it almost sounds like a sort of biblical, mythological tale of survival, talking about watching their friends get eaten by lions and having to swim across rivers full of crocodiles, and then magically somehow many of them surviving and making their way to this refugee camp in Kenya where they lived for 10 years before resettling to the United States.
And we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about surviving here in the United States, some of the issues that these young men faced when they were resettled here in the United States and continue to face. This is Liz Brown, Mondays at 9. I'm talking to John Schneck, one of the producers, directors of the documentary The Lost Boys of Sudan, joining us from San Francisco. My name is Liz Brown. I'll be back after this break. Stay with us.
Stick around for more of the best of the wake-up call. Up next, this is AM 920 WGNU.
That's the Big Dipper over there.
Yellow and blue make green.
Well, a cow pie really isn't a pie.
Come on, friends, open your eyes!
Remember, you're always teaching. Teach carefully. React with rage, and kids will learn it's okay to do the same. Keep your cool, and kids will do likewise. For advice, visit actagainstviolence.org. Brought to you by MetLife Foundation, National Association for the Education of Young Children, and the Ad Council.
Is your church, school, or nonprofit organization holding an upcoming event, or does it have an ongoing program? We can help you get the word out free of charge here at WGNU. Just send a flyer or written information to WGNU Radio Public Service Department, 265 Union Boulevard, St. Louis, Missouri 63108. We ask 2 weeks lead time for any upcoming event. WGNU reserves the right to edit or reject any submission due to content and time considerations. Was Sheikh Jerry Lewis Bey the Moor a government target or gangster? Read the Jerry Lewis Bey story and decide for yourself. Available online at Amazon.com or locally at the Ujamaa Bookstore. Published by Stallion Group Publications.
This is Mitch Washington of the St. Louis office of Edward Jones, located at 200 North Broadway downtown, inviting you to tune in to Radio Free St. Louis for the WGNU Stock Market Recap. Weekday afternoons, immediately following the 3:30 traffic update. Find out how your investments are doing and how the numbers on Wall Street are affecting you. That's the WGNU Stock Market Recap with me, Mitch Washington, weekday afternoons at 3:30 on Radio Free St. Louis, AM 920 WGNU.
Prizes awarded on WGNU will be held for pickup at the radio station for 30 days. After 30 days, all items become the sole property of WGNU Radio to be disposed of at our discretion. In the case of event tickets, tickets will be held for 30 days or until the date of the event, whichever comes first. Prizes must be picked up at our studios, which are located at 265 Union Boulevard in St. Louis, unless otherwise specified.
Big Brother is watching, and we're watching Big Brother. It's the award-winning wake-up call with Liz Brown.
Now we take you back to the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
This is Mondays at 9 with Liz Brown, where we take a closer look at issues and people shaping our world. Once again, here's Liz Brown.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Mondays at 9. I'm talking to John Schneck, one of the producers, directors of the documentary The Lost Boys of Sudan, joining us from San Francisco. John, talk to us about how Peter and Santino, how they connected to their lives in America. First of all, where were they taken to live, and are they still there?
Well, they were originally taken to Houston, Texas, where about 120 or so Lost Boys live. They were resettled by the YMCA, which was the agency that was doing the work of resettlement in Houston to a great extent. And they were placed in an apartment in Houston with about three or four other Lost Boys. And they were kind of directed towards jobs that, you know, sort of menial jobs that were minimum wage type jobs. Santino began to work in a factory assembling hard drives for computers on the night shift. And Peter, who was a little more antsy about finding something that he called kind of proudful work, work that he could use his mind with and something that he could have some pride in, was not satisfied with something like that. And he really tried to find something that would be something that he could be proud of, and he didn't find menial work something that he could call back and tell his friends in Africa that he was doing with any kind of pride. And so he very quickly got frustrated with Houston. He worked for a temp agency for a while, and he heard after a few months that a cousin of his had a friend who was going to high school in Kansas. And so he got in his car one day, which he had bought, a used car, and he literally drove himself to Kansas.
And he didn't tell his friend?
No, he didn't tell his friends. He didn't tell anybody. He didn't tell us. He didn't tell nobody that he was living with really had much of an idea where he was with. We, fortunately, we were able to fairly quickly figure out what had happened. We got on the phone to some guys, some Sudanese guys that we knew in California. And somebody knew a friend of Peter's that might know, and we called them, and we sort of tracked them down, and we got on a plane and we were in Kansas City the next day.
Where why did he do it like that? Did you talk to him about what caused him to just get in his car and go? It's not like he's driven across the country before. I mean, I'm certain that he hadn't driven much more than just around the streets of Houston.
Yeah, I mean, it's we were just amazed.
Well, I guess if you've gone 1,000 miles from Sudan to Kenya through rivers and all of that stuff, getting in a car traveling is not that big of a deal.
You're absolutely right. I mean, in his mind, he thought, well, I have no allegiance to Houston. It's arbitrarily, it was given to me as a place to live. There's no reason for me to stay there if I feel like there's a opportunity somewhere else. And parenthetically, immigrants to this country and refugees to this country do often do what's called a second migration once they get here. You know, they discover that they have a family member or a friend that can get them a good job or a good school in another place, and they often do things like this. So it's not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
But we were totally taken aback by it and felt like, wow, what an incredible thing to do. And his take on it was not so much that he was turning his back on his friends. Obviously, he didn't feel that way himself. He felt like, look, you know, I need to do what I need to do in order to make my life move forward. And he felt like he just was not going to get the satisfaction that he wanted of getting into school and getting a decent job where he was. And he felt like the agency in Houston was not helping him.
And despite the name of the film, The Lost Boys of Sudan, he's not, by any stretch of the mean, a boy.
No, I mean, this is, you're talking about a guy who's, you know, who we don't know exactly, but somewhere in the range of 18 to 21.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt like he was kind of given a little bit of a raw deal. He felt like his age that the government had, that the UN had given him arbitrarily was actually older than he was, and that he really did deserve to be in high school because he felt when he entered this country that he was 18, and that because of that he should be in high school.
So did he get into high school?
He did. He ended up getting having his Sudanese birth certificate reissued and sent to him in Kansas, which said that he was under 18. And he walked into a high school in Olathe, Kansas, which is a suburb of Kansas City. And they were very generous and offered him a spot. And he took it and really took to it. When he made his way into that suburban high school, he felt like he had reached some kind of Shangri-La. I mean, you know, free school with nice people and, you know, in a pleasant, clean place. And he really felt like, you know, this was what he had come to the United States for.
Well, let's talk about the issue that America has a difficult time talking about, the issue of race. And racism here in the United States. Did either Peter or Santino have stories to tell about the issue of race? And also, as white filmmakers, what did you discover about race in this country in the making of this film with these young men?
Well, the story for us started when we arrived in the refugee camp in Africa. One of the first things that these young men asked us and wanted to know about America was, is it true that all young black men in the States are in prison?
Mm.
And Megan and I sort of looked at each other and we wanted to cry because the question is such a complicated one. I mean, our first initial response is, well, no, that's not true. Don't worry about it. But, of course, there is an element of truth in what they're asking, which is that our country does have a crisis with race, and there is a disproportionate number of young black men who are in prison who do get into trouble.
And also, we have a country that targets African men and puts them in prison
exactly.
as well.
We have a legacy in our country of racism, which has led us to this peculiar and unpleasant point of having a crisis. And these guys, because they're black, you know, we're stepping into this situation where a large number of Americans, we're going to see them as young black men.
And also as people who didn't speak very much English, the issue that had been exported to this lowly refugee camp in Kenya is the issue of racism and the racist stereotypes of African people.
Well, you put your finger on a really important thing, which is that the other part of that question that was really incredibly depressing to us, which is, was that it was the first one they asked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, of all the things about America that make their way out into the world, and Lord knows there's a number of things that our country exports in terms of our culture, one of the first things was that there's an incredible problem of racism in our country. And so you gotta, we start to think about that. Well, wow, I mean, that's the one thing that these guys know about our country.
And it's a lie. If the question was, are all black men in jail, it's a lie, and it's a lie based upon race, and it's a lie based upon racism, and it had no problem traveling.
It's a lie, but it's also a lie that has an incredible history behind mm-hmm. it, which suggests something which is true, which is that our country has because of the legacy of slavery and racism and on, we do have a crisis that we still have not solved.
Absolutely.
And it's incredibly complicated and incredibly dark and depressing. And so these guys were scared about that, and as they had the right to be.
And in terms of, because I'm so sorry, John, we only have a couple more, well, we only have a minute here left.
Yes, yes.
In terms of their relationships with people of African descent here in this country, did they create those types of bonds with any people of African descent?
Yeah, I mean, you see in the film that there are a couple of interactions they have with African Americans, and there are some connections that got made. We really thought that there had not been enough communication on behalf of the government and the agencies to get these guys connected to African-American groups. And mm-hmm. we really hope that one thing the film can do is start this kind of conversation where black Africans coming as refugees and immigrants can connect to African-Americans who live in the United States.
And in terms of where people can get a hold of this film and see this film, where can they go, John?
Well, the film recently came out on DVD in November, so it's available. If you go to lostboysfilm.com, which is our website, which has, by the way, incredible resources for educators and community groups who and just for people who are interested in getting more information and perhaps getting involved with refugee resettlement in their own communities. And there's a link on the site to the company that sells the video. You can go to Netflix or Amazon and any number of places. Retail video stores to find the DVD.
John Schneck, thank you so much for joining us here on the Wake Up Call.
Thank you very much.
Happy holidays.
You too.
Listen, folks, Liz Brown, Wake Up Call. I'll be back.
You've been listening to the best of the Wake Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU. Up next, the news, traffic, and your weather, then more of the best of the Wake Up Call. This is AM 920 WGNU.
Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
For the issues that matter most, it's AM 920 WGNU, Granite City, St. Louis.
Here's the latest from ABC News. I'm Daria Aldinger. 4 years ago today, President Bush said major combat in Iraq was over for U.S. troops.
This much is certain. No terrorist network will gain weapons of mass destruction from the Iraqi regime because the regime is no more.
That wasn't the case today. The president heads to CENTCOM for a progress report on the operation. ABC's Ann Compton is making the trip with the president.
4 years ago, the American president thought he saw rapid success in Iraq.
Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
The president never spoke the words mission accomplished. Those were on a banner behind him. Ann Compton, ABC News, Andrews Air Force Base, near Washington.
The president is also getting a special delivery today from Congress, a bill to pay for the war, which he's already promised to veto.
And another reminder of how circumstances have changed. Congressional Democrats plan a special ceremony today as they present President Bush with a bill that demands a date certain for U.S. withdrawal from Iraq.
ABC's Claire Shipman in Washington. We are paying an average of $2.97 a gallon for gas nationwide, and we're not even to the busy summer driving season yet. Analyst Peter Butel is watching those numbers.
There have only been three other days that have settled higher than the numbers that we've seen here recently. So we're right near the all-time high.
He says $4 a gallon gas is a possibility. A gallon of gas is cheap compared to the price of milk in some places. New Yorkers are forking over more than $3.50 for a gallon of moo juice. It's because of ethanol, which is made from corn, which is what dairy cows usually eat. This is May Day. It's a workers' holiday in communist nations around the world, including in Cuba, where large crowds are gathering in Havana. But so far, there's no sign of Fidel Castro, who is supposed to be there. This is ABC News.
Order! Order in the court!
It's time to render your decision. You've made up your mind, but you're twitching from the itching, squirming from the burning, and everyone's hanging on your every word.
I should have used Preparation H. Quick recess!
Where's he going?
You should carry Preparation H portable wipes, the discreet way to get big relief. They're convenient little packets that hold very big wipes, so you can cleanse, cool, and soothe to get relief even when you're not at home.
Order! Now, my decision.
Preparation H portable wipes. Big relief to go. Uses directed.
Today, many advances in technology have benefited the field of criminal justice, and new jobs are emerging. How can you get involved? The ITT Tech School of Criminal Justice. With a degree in criminal justice, you can pursue various career opportunities involving corrections, workplace security, and private investigations. Call now for an ITT Tech brochure. 800-ITT-3169. That's 800-ITT-3169. Not offered at every campus. Check the ITT Tech for a list of programs offered.
A tragedy under the big top last night in California. A trapeze artist performing with a Mexican circus troupe fell to his death. This is not a list you want to top, but L.A. gets the dubious distinction of being the nation's most polluted city. Here's ABC's Alex Stone.
Southern Californians are breathing the country's dirtiest air. That's according to the American Lung Association's bad air list. Pittsburgh is number two, followed by Bakersfield, California, Birmingham, Alabama, Detroit, and Cleveland. The rankings are based on ozone pollution levels. The Lung Association says nearly half of the U.S. population lives in counties with unhealthy air. Last on the list at number 24 is Rome, Georgia. Alex Stone, ABC News, Los Angeles.
Looking for love? It could be as close as your local supermarket. Upscale grocer Whole Foods is sponsoring singles nights in some cities. Shoppers are given ribbons to wear, red for taken, blue for available. They say so far it's been pretty successful. I'm Daria Albinger, ABC News.
Now, the local report from the WGNU Newsroom.
Good morning, St. Louis. This is Patrick Brandmeier with your WGNU News Update for the 8 o'clock hour. In the news this Tuesday, a local high school coach is dead after collapsing on a school road trip. Dismet lacrosse coach Mike Sennett died Saturday morning near South Bend, Indiana. He was with his team at a tournament and complained of discomfort, leading to an assistant coach calling 911. Sennett lost consciousness and was transported to an Indiana hospital where he was pronounced dead. Sennett had led the Dismet lacrosse team to a state championship in 2001. School officials say they will likely hold a memorial service in the school chapel next week. A tie has been broken in a Metro East election. Yesterday, a lottery system was used to decide the winner of a trustee election in Swansea, Illinois. Early returns had incumbent Michael Leopold winning by one vote, but after late ballots were counted, the voting was tied between Leopold and challenger Dave Thacker. A Freebird policeman drew Leopold's name out of a hat, making him the winner of the election that took place 2 weeks ago. Thacker says he will not ask for a recount. Finally this hour, the Cardinals continue their series against the NL Central leading Brewers this evening in Milwaukee. Braden Looper takes the mound for the Cardinals with a record of 3-1 and a 1.91 ERA. He will be opposed by Ben Sheets, who is 1-2 on the year with a 4.50 ERA. Sheets has had trouble with the Cards in the past with a 4-14 career record against St. Louis. He had to leave his most recent start on April 25th with a slight groin strain. Game time tonight is 7:05. That's your look at local news for the 8 o'clock hour. I'm Patrick Brandmeier, bringing you the news that matters most to you.
Good morning, St. Louis. 6 minutes after the hour of 8 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton. Let's take a look at this hour's traffic and weather. A lot of stuff going on 270, so let's get to it. Northbound 270 between 55 and Tesson Ferry. Stop traffic. There's an accident. Three lanes are blocked. Only left lane is getting through in both directions, so expect a lot of delays on northbound 270. Northbound 55 from 141 through 270, look for stop-and-go traffic as a result of the 270 accident. It's causing a lot of delays on northbound 55 as well. Westbound 270 from Old Halls Ferry into Graham Hanley, you've got stop-and-go traffic. Eastbound 40 between Maryville Center and Mason Road, look for an accident cleared that's near Mason. Look for stop-and-go traffic. Northbound 270 from Dorset through 70, look for delays in the 70 exit lanes. Southbound 270 from St. Charles Rock Road through 70, look for an accident. Left lane's blocked. It's south of 70. All northbound lanes are now reopened, but you've got stop-and-go traffic going on there as well. Westbound 5570 from 64 into the Poplar Street Bridge. Look for delays. Westbound 64 from Bow Avenue. Look for no problems to report there. And westbound 270 from Old Hulse Ferry into Graham Hanley. You've got stop-and-go traffic. Eastbound, westbound Kingbridge traffic from the Gravel Pit into the Landing. Look for delays. Northbound 55 from 3200 South Broadway into 44. Look for slowdowns there as well. That is a look at this hour's traffic. Now let's take a look at your forecast for today, tomorrow, and for Thursday. Partly sunny this morning, otherwise mostly cloudy, and a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs in the mid-80s this evening. Showers and thunderstorms likely low around 60s Wednesday. Showers and thunderstorms with a high in the lower 70s Wednesday evening. Showers and thunderstorms low in the upper 50s. And Thursday, showers and thunderstorms likely with a high in the lower 70s. Currently in the studios of AM 920 WGNU, we have 72 degrees, overcast skies. Lambert Field is already at 75 degrees in overcast skies. Stay tuned for more of Liz Brown, actually the best of the wake-up call. Liz Brown is out today. She will be back tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., so we'll bring you more of the best of the wake-up call. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU. We'll take another look at your traffic and weather in the bottom of the 8 o'clock hour. This is AM 920 WGNU, your station for the issues that matter most to you.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell my brother, tell my sister. I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell my brother, tell my sister.
Our power. Please do not beg folks for power. Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Some very sad news for all of you, the people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below that below me.
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it.
A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal. Yet many are denied equal treatment.
And so we say to all in this nation who dare listen to us, black, white,
and now bring you more of the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
It's a long and difficult struggle.
Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Santa cutie, and fill my stocking with a duplex and checks. Sign. One little thing. a ring. I don't mean on the phone, Santa baby.
Welcome back. Welcome back to the Wake Up Call. This is Liz Brown, living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number. 454-6609 is my fax. And my toll-free long-distance number is 1-877-920-WGNU. That's 1-877-920-WGNU. You need to get up. You need to get to me. We have much, much, much to talk about. 454-0400 is my phone number. In the last hour, I mentioned a story that I think bears repeating this hour. It's a story that comes, of course, not out of our multi-billion-dollar media industry. It's a story that comes out of The Guardian. And it's a Guardian reporter that is located here in the United States in the city of Los Angeles. And it's a story that underscores the fact that Hollywood has joined the war. Universal Pictures announced that it will make a movie, The Battle for Fallujah. They've even gone so far as to hire actor Harrison Ford as the lead in a movie that they're saying is about an effort to defeat the insurgency. This movie will be based on the yet-to-be-finished book entitled No True Glory, The Battle for Fallujah by Bing West. Bing West has been quoted as saying, "If America needs a hard job done, the Marines will do it, and they won't lose their humanity in the process or any sleep over pulling the trigger. Yes, they are the world's most lethal killing machine. That's what America needs in battle." Having said that, I think it is going to be fairly clear that in this movie, made by Hollywood, as Hollywood has joined the war effort, this movie will, is doubtful that this movie will have very many Iraqi faces in it, and that the Iraqi people will not figure very prominently in this. The reality is that the Iraqi people have figured very prominently in the war in Iraq, and in particular in the battle against Fallujah. This morning I have joining me Gail Murphy, co-founder of CoPink, a women's peace group. And Gail is also a member of the Delegation of Families for Peace that are headed to Fallujah. And Gail's going to tell us why. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm outstanding. Gail, you are part of a delegation of people that are headed to Fallujah. Tell us about who you are.
Well, I'm a woman who has decided to devote the majority of her life right now to ending the war and occupation in Iraq. I joined Code Pink before the war started. Code Pink grew out of a sentiment that the threat of attack on Iraq was truly a potential disaster. And so we created a vigil in front of the White House, which we held for 4 months. And then we organized a women's peace rally in March, where 10,000 women came from all over the country. We marched to the White House. We surrounded it. And we've been working tirelessly ever since to try to end this war and to bring our troops home.
Didn't you also confront Hillary Clinton about her position on the war?
We did, among many others. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we actually went to her office to find out what her position was and where she stood. We knew she had voted for the resolution to go to war, But we wanted to know if, with new information, she was shifting, and she wasn't, so we gave her a pink slip that day, and there were about, I'd say about 100 of us dressed in pink in Congress. And we did not leave her office until she would meet with us, and she did.
Did you find that, were you surprised by that?
That she would meet with us?
No, are you surprised by her response to you? Because it wasn't a very, her rep is, the word out there on her is that she would obviously be supportive of your efforts.
Right. Well, not really. She had voted for the resolution. She was married to the president before, so she was getting the intelligence, warped as we now know it is. And I think that as a senator from New York, she was under pressure to show a hawkish attitude to, you know, in essence, supposedly to protect the people of New York after 9/11, because those links between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein were still being made, and we now know that. We've known all along, the peace movement has known all along that they were specious connections.
So you're a delegation of an organization, Code Pink, that has joined other delegations that are about peace as well.
Right. Well, we actually, when the war started, we continued our protests in Washington, but after the, in July, a year and a half ago nearly now, we went back to Baghdad, and we opened an occupation watch center with other international peace groups to monitor the occupation, the conduct of the military, the conduct of contractors, to really find out what America's intentions were in the United States and also how Iraqis were living under occupation. We needed to get that information back to particularly the coalition countries to inform the peace groups that all that was being reported in mainstream media and by the coalition governments was not as it really was. Iraqis were truly suffering under the occupation. And we wanted to make sure that that was known to the rest of the world.
So talk to us.
So we organized delegations under the Occupation Watch Center. We organized delegation of journalists, peace activists, women, university professors, and we had a delegation of parliamentarians that were about to go in April of last year to really take a look at what the policies of the U.S. government and the interim Iraqi government and how that was going to affect the democratization process. And that delegation was canceled because of the first attack on Fallujah, and it just became too difficult to travel.
So talk to us about the humanitarian crisis that is in Iraq and in particular in Fallujah.
Well, obviously the physical assault on Iraq is wreaking havoc on people's lives. The electricity availability is minimal. It's, for some people, it's an hour a day. The water quality is terrible because of the destruction of water systems and also just the degradation because the promised contractors, either haven't organized themselves to do the work and now find it too difficult to do the work given the security situation. When the U.S. invaded Iraq, they did not protect the borders, so all kinds of people have come in and are now also creating havoc in Iraq. The crime situation is out of control. The U.S. is not providing security. The Iraqis are not able to provide security. So really it's a Pandora's box, and the lid has been lifted off, and the Iraqis are suffering as a result.
How many people are we talking about that are in Fallujah now?
I don't know how many have been able to return, but the estimates are that there are 150,000 refugees from this most recent assault and living under very difficult conditions. In fact, we're trying to get video interviews and footage of the situation out as we speak. We have an Iraqi colleague who is trying to get to Fallujah. It's very difficult to enter. The U.S. has surrounded it with barricades. It's very strict entry. We've heard that they're taking DNA samples and eye scans so that they can keep track of everyone who's there. But also fighting is continuing in Fallujah. So it is not... whatever the U.S. intention in Fallujah was to root out the insurgents, it's not worked.
So what is it that you all are planning to do?
I think that one thing that we have found to be of critical importance is a people-to-people connection, to certainly let the Iraqis know that they're Americans who never agreed to this war, who are fighting to stop the war and the occupation, who are demanding that the troops be brought home now, that there are political, diplomatic, and structural things that can be done alternative to war in Iraq. And so I think it's important for many of us to go as close to Iraq now as we can. We can no longer go in safely. So our intention is...
You cannot go into Iraq at all.
Well, it's just too dangerous for foreigners right now. There are so many elements operating, you know, for various reasons, whether it's a criminal element wanting to, you know, to rob, whether it's anti-American elements, whether it's U.S. military, Iraqi government. You know, they're not exactly keen on seeing peace activists in Iraq. So there are, you know, many reasons that we... now consider it a risk to go into Iraq right now. So going to Jordan is as close as we can get to continue carrying our message of peace, and that we as Americans and many internationals also care about the Iraqi people, that we're continuing our struggle to end this disaster and to try to find retribution for them.
Who are some of the people that are going to be making this journey with you?
They are members of... military family members who have lost loved ones in Iraq and who believe that it is an unjust war and also want to carry this message and help the people of Fallujah. Also members of families who have lost loved ones during the 9/11,
the attack on
the attack on the Twin Towers.
Now, about how many people do you think are going to be able to make the journey with you?
I think we are going to be at least a dozen. We also have other peace activists who are going to be joining us from United for Peace and Justice. I will be taking a video camera. There will also be another video camera there.
What will you hope to film?
When we get to Iraq, we're going to be meeting with Jordanian peace activists and Iraqis who are in Jordan.
So, and we're talking about the Iraq-Jordan border here.
Yes, we are.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't
Amman, the capital of Jordan, is about 12-hour drive to Baghdad, and that's usually how we enter into Iraq, is to drive from Amman to Baghdad. But this time we'll only be going to the border. And at the border we're hoping to meet with Iraqi families who are able to make the journey. And that's still a question, because the road between Baghdad and Amman is not a safe one. It's safe up to the border, but there have been serious attacks on the road. There are parts of the road that are controlled by the U.S. military where people cannot enter. But we're hoping that we will be able to meet with Iraqi families who also have lost loved ones in this disaster.
And you'll be videotaping that as well.
And we'll be videotaping.
Will there be any problems with you videotaping that? Do you anticipate any problems?
Not if there are no military or Iraqi government authorities around. There has been a real media blackout in Iraq. I think you probably know that Al Jazeera is now out of the country.
Yes.
There's been a slow campaign to completely eliminate them from being able to report. No one is allowed into Fallujah, as far as I know at this point. No one is allowed to videotape in hospitals and clinics. Certainly no military installations are allowed to be videotaped. Journalists really have a tough time in Iraq. And I think it's an interesting story, the genesis of this delegation and our humanitarian effort. Dar Jamail, who is a young, an American independent journalist, has worked over the last year in Iraq reporting back to us. And his seeing of the second attack on Fallujah, he was so devastated by the destruction and the displacement of people and the loss of life that he gave us really the idea to try and get immediate relief to the people. And so he organized a group of doctors who volunteered to receive money from us that we were able to get to them. And they bought medicines and supplies, and simple things like blanket and clean water, to be able to get to the refugees immediately. The Red Crescent was undersupplied. The international non-governmental agencies working in Iraq are out of Iraq. And as far as we could tell, the Ministry of Health was doing nothing in terms of emergency relief. So it was just something we couldn't refuse doing, and he was willing to coordinate this effort, and it's been really, you know, it's a small contribution given the enormity of the disaster, but at least it's something that we can do directly.
And how much money were you able to raise, and how many supplies were you able to put together?
We have raised close to $100,000 in a matter of weeks, I think.
And you did that largely on the Internet?
Yes. I think we've sent out alerts, and people responded immediately. I think it's been in this... You know, with the re-election of George Bush and the obvious continuation of our foreign policy and our aggression on the people of Iraq, I think that people pulled themselves out of a sort of depression and realized that this was a very tangible thing that they could do to help.
Were you at all concerned about where the money was coming for your humanitarian efforts? Because
where it was going?
No,
or?
Where it was coming from, given this our current government's actions of getting at people that are giving money for different actions. We've had people that, you know, Iraqi organizations, people giving money to those organizations, people receiving money from those organizations, have been held in suspicion by our government.
Mm-hmm.
So were you all at all concerned about that?
No, I wouldn't say so. No, because, you know, we know the doctors who are working with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there are any questions, we know that we're not doing anything illegal. We're not aiding and abetting the enemy. You know, this and most of the money has come from the women of Code Pink who have really resonated with our call to help the people of Fallujah.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I'm talking to Gail Murphy, co-founder of Code Pink, a women's peace group, and also she's a member of the Delegation of Families for Peace, a group of people that are a delegation that's headed to Iraq for humanitarian reasons. We will be back, folks, to take some of your calls and to continue our conversation with Gail Murphy. I'm Liz Brown. This is The Wake Up Call. Stay with me. We have much, much
more. You're listening to the best of The Wake Up Call. Stick around for more following the traffic and your weather. Good morning, St. Louis. 30 minutes after the hour of 6 o'clock or 8 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU. I'm Howard Morton. Let's take a look at this hour's traffic. Southbound 270 from St. Charles Rock Road through Dorset. Look for stop traffic of disabled vehicles. Center lanes blocked reportedly south of 70. Northbound 270 between Dorset and 70. Look for stop and go traffic due to an accident that's been cleared. Southbound 55 between Gasconade and 4500 South Broadway. Stop and go traffic due to an accident that's on a ramp to 4500 South Broadway. Northbound 55 from Butler Hill through 270. You can expect slow traffic. Westbound 270 from 367 to Graham Hanley. Look for slow traffic there as well. Eastbound 40 between 141 and Mason. Look for that accident to have been cleared around Mason. Expect some delays there. Westbound 5570 from 3rd Street into the Poplar Street Bridge. Look for stop and go traffic. Eastbound 70 from Bryan Road through 79. Look for slow traffic there. Westbound Kingbridge traffic from the gravel pit into the landing. Look for delays. Southbound 170 from St. Charles Rock Road through Del Mar. Look for some slowdowns. Northbound 55 from 3200 South Broadway into 44. Look for heavy volume there. Northbound 270 from Tesson Ferry through 44. There's an accident that's been cleared. Expect some delays. Westbound 70 from 5th Street into 94. Road construction has the left lane closed. And eastbound 70 from Earth City Expressway into past St. Charles Rock Road. Look for some slowdowns there as well. That is a look at your traffic. Now let's take a look at your forecast for today, tomorrow, and for Thursday. Partly sunny this morning, otherwise mostly cloudy, and chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon, high in the mid-80s this evening. Showers and thunderstorms likely with a low around 60. Wednesday, showers and thunderstorms again with a high in the lower 70s, and pretty much the same all the way through Thursday. Currently at the studios of AM 920 WGNU, we have overcast skies, 73 degrees, Lambert Fields reporting 75. Stay tuned for more of the best of The Wake Up Call. It's up next. We'll take another look at your News, traffic, and weather in the 9 o'clock hour. Up next, more of the best of the wake-up call. I'm Howard Morton for AM 920 WGNU, your station for the issues that matter most to you.
Good morning. This is Liz Brown, and I would like to invite you to a grand music extravaganza and CD release. Where? At Central VPA High School, May 1st at 9:30 a.m. and again at 7 p.m. The extravaganza will feature the Performing Arts Percussion Wind String and Guitar Ensembles and the Jazz Show Choir, the Glee Club, and last but not least, Dr. Stanley Ingram and the Faculty Jazz Band. Admission, $3 per student per person at 9:30 a.m. and then $5 per person at 7 p.m. The location, 3125 South Kings Highway. For more information, call 771-2772. That's 771-2772. Don't miss it and pick up one of their CDs. You'll love it.
Developing Healthy Relationships is a free program in 4 sessions beginning Saturday, May 5th from 10 to 11:30 a.m. All sessions will be held at Woman's Place at 7372 Marietta Avenue in Maplewood. Pre-registration is required. For more info, call 314-645-4848. Something for Women from WGNU.
Praise the Lord, church family, it's me, Pastor E to the J to the D, yours truly, doing my duty, live in the loop on WGNU, 920 on your AM dial, and we just praising him a while. Check it out, church family, we got a brand new broadcast coming at you. It's the Friday Night Radio Broadcast Fellowship Hour, every Friday night, 8 to 9 p.m. on your W, my W, IWGNU.
If you have suffered roof damage from the recent severe weather, Phil Person Roofing is still a name you can trust. Licensed and certified for commercial and residential jobs, Phil Person Roofing offers free estimates for all work. To contact Person Roofing, call this special emergency number, 602-1047. That's 602-1047. Phil Person Roofing, 602-1047.
Anywhere in the world at WGNU.net. The award-winning wake-up call with Liz Brown.
Now we take you back to the best of the wake-up call. We'll take another look at your news, traffic, and weather in the 9 o'clock hour.
Welcome back to the Wake Up Call. This is Liz Brown, living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number, 454-6609 is my fax. If you want to toll-free long-distance me, you can do that at 1-877-920-WGNU. I am talking to, this morning, Gail Murphy, co-founder of Code Pink, a women's peace group, and also a member of the Delegation of Families for Peace, joining us from Washington, D.C. Gail is talking to us about the trip that she and other delegates will make from December 27th to January 4th to deliver humanitarian supplies to refugees from the United States' attack on Fallujah. Gail, welcome back.
Thank you.
Talk to us about how the goods, the humanitarian supplies that you are taking over to Fallujah, or at least at the Jordan-Iraq border, how are they going to be distributed?
We are intending to both, as I mentioned before, there are doctors, Iraqi doctors, who have been working with us already and have made distributions to the refugee camps. And through local organizations that have been set up spontaneously to help the refugees.
and if I might interrupt for one second, define what a refugee in Iraq is.
Well, in the case of Fallujah, it's someone who had to suddenly leave their home because of a aggressive attack on their town. And some of these people left most of the people left really in a hurry, and it's winter in Iraq right now, and it's quite cold, and people didn't have time to bring clothing.
People don't think about that. You don't think of Iraq as being cold.
Mm-hmm. So no, it's in the 40s at night right now. So people left without adequate clothing. So one of the items that we've been distributing are blankets, just to keep families warm, because they're living in sort of makeshift housing and in halls of mosques and wherever people will put them up, because there have been no preparations for the exodus that's happened because of the attack. And Fallujah has been nearly destroyed, so a lot of people don't have homes to return to. I think the expectation on the part of the Fallujans was that they would, you know, they would just kind of hunker down, there would be a surgical attack, and they'd be able to, you know, rise out of it fairly easily. But it's not the case. And so we want to also find out what their condition is. When are they going to be able to return? What kind of assistance are they getting from the Iraqi government and from the U.S. military?
And you hope to get that information from who?
Well, reports from people who are going to be joining us, coming up from those areas to join us. And also, as I said, we have a colleague who's videotaping interviews right now, trying to get stories from the refugees of what happened. We're not getting that in mainstream media. I haven't seen a single report, I don't think, on broadcast television about what people are living right now.
Well, as you heard in my intro, Hollywood is making a movie on this, and it's not going to have anything to do with the Iraqi people.
It's going to be about glorifying war and military aggression and dominance.
So when I've been to Africa, and I've been to the Sudan, I've been to the refugee camps in Sudan. We don't have that in Iraq. Do we? Do we have refugee camps, or are people, you really have to go and seek people out to find them?
Well, I think, yes, they're makeshift camps. And as I understand it, because the Red Crescent is undersupplied, and there are no preparations, there were no preparations made for people who had to leave, you know, people in Baghdad have been putting people up, and there have been these makeshift, settlements that have been established. But it's civilians who are helping them out, and whoever is willing to step up. And actually, that's been the case every time there's been a major military assault on a city. When Najaf was attacked, and that's a Shiite city. Sunnis organized to take blood, to take medicines, to take bandages. In the first attack, again, it was the citizens who organized to get relief to the people who were under attack.
Do we know of a single hospital that exists for the people of Iraq after in Fallujah?
I don't know what the conditions are. I understand that there was a hospital and a clinic that were bombed. I don't know if they're still operating, and that's information that we'll be getting. But that's part of one of the objectives of this delegation is to raise awareness about what are the conditions of the medical facilities, not just in Fallujah, but elsewhere in Iraq. Dar Jamail had done a report for us on the conditions of hospitals and clinics. He did a sample, and we'll be releasing that report while we're in Jordan. And I have to say that, we're very concerned about the millions of dollars that have been given to contractors, U.S. contractors, to go and strengthen the healthcare system in Iraq. And we're understanding that it's still in decline, that there are not adequate supplies. Doctors and nurses are working under terrible conditions. You've got open sewage in some places. You have inadequate space and beds and emergency equipment. So we're asking the question, beside this this emergency situation, in general, what is the U.S. doing that it promised to help in the reconstruction effort?
And let's take a call here. You have a question or comment for our guest, Gail Murphy.
Yeah, my question is this. Why do you really feel that the United States is in Iraq?
Thanks for your question.
Well, I mean, I'm not finished, but the one question there, and I'll go further with that.
Okay, what is your next question, please?
Okay, I mean, do you feel that we have, ulterior motives other than oil or some other economic gain, other than freedom, peace, or democracy?
Thanks for your call and question. Gail.
Well, I do believe that oil is a major factor in our preemptive attack on Iraq and our desire to control the country. And I also, there are other resources in Iraq that we can gain from. While Bremer, the American who was sent to Iraq to sort of govern the whole situation and set up this interim government that is under our control, and basically there is a puppet government under U.S. control working in Iraq, he opened up all of Iraqi assets to the availability of international companies to be able to buy them. We don't even have that in this country. International companies cannot own more than 50% of any of our assets in the U.S.
Which would be insane, and no country should want other countries to own their national assets like that.
Right, and it's illegal under Geneva Conventions. You're not allowed to change the economic system of a country that you're occupying. It's up to the people to do that. It should be left up to the Iraqis to decide how they want, what kind of an economic system they want to create.
Mm-hmm. All right, we have to take a break. We'll get to some more of our callers. I'm talking to Gail Murphy, co-founder of Code Pink, a women's peace organization. Gail is also a member of the delegation Families for Peace, a delegation that will be journeying to Jordan, the border of Jordan and Iraq, to deliver about $600,000 worth of humanitarian supplies for the refugees from the U.S. attack on Fallujah. We'll be back to talk to Gail Murphy more. This is Liz Brown, The Wake Up Call. Stay with us.
You're listening to the best of The Wake Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU. Stick around for more and your local news, weather, and traffic in the 9 o'clock hour.
Several years, you've heard WGNU's community calendar of events going on in and around the area. Ever wonder where the information comes from? The majority of it comes from our listening audience. If your nonprofit organization would like help promoting its events and ongoing operations free of charge, send all necessary information to calendar@wgnu.net. Please send the correspondence 2 weeks prior to any events. WGNU reserves the right to edit or reject submissions for reasons of time and content.
This is Dr. Laura Schlesinger. Join me weekday afternoons from 2 till 4 on AM 920. WGNU discusses the issues that matter most to you every day. And if you have a relationship problem with a friend, coworker, or family member, it really matters to me. So call me at 1-800-DR-LAURA. That's 1-800-DR-LAURA. Tune in every Monday through Friday afternoon from 2 until 4 and take on the day with me, Dr. Laura, on AM 920 WGNU.
The St. Louis Art Museum presents a gallery talk on portraiture and perspective on Friday at 6 p.m. The discussion will be led by Andrew Walker, curator of American art, and Charlotte Ironman, curator of modern and contemporary art at the museum. Space may be limited in smaller galleries, so please arrive early. Meet at the Information Center. Admission is free. For more information, call 314-721-0072 or visit slam.org. News to you from WGNU.
Hello, I'm John Womack. I have a new show on WGNU called On the Table.
Some of the things we'll talk about will be restaurants, food and wine trends, recipes. But really, we're just trying to help you experience great food and wine, whether you're at home or out on the town. So if you love great food and wine, you'll love On the Tape. Be listening every Tuesday at noon here on WGNU.
Around the world, behind the story. It's the award-winning Wake Up Call with Liz Brown.
Now we take you back to the best of the Wake Up Call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
When Christmas is near. Welcome back to the Wake Up Call. I'm talking to Gail Murphy, co-founder of Code Pink, a women's peace group. Gail is also a member of the delegation for Families for Peace. She's joining us from Washington, D.C., part of a delegation that will be traveling to Jordan, the border of Jordan and Iraq, December 27th to January 4th to deliver some $600,000 worth of humanitarian supplies for the Iraqi refugees from the U.S. attack on Fallujah. Gail, welcome back. Let's get to another caller, please. Ben, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to ask your guests, and I guess a lot of people, it's just an open question. Are we ready to concede that if Saddam Hussein was still in power, that the Iraqi people would not be suffering like they are? Now, it seems like he was a tyrant. He was so awful. He was a monster. But he could control all of those people in Iraq, and he seemed to have brought them minimum state of prosperity, even in the face of no-fly zones, sanctions, and so forth. We look around, and every congressman, everybody who was supposed to be against the war, the first thing they have to do before a journalist asks them a question is run their little standard disclaimer. Well, I agree that Saddam was a monster and we're better off without him. But this is, you know, and then so on and so on. No, we aren't better off without him.
All right, we can see that. All right. Thanks for your call and for your observation. Are the Iraqi people worse off today than they were under Saddam Hussein?
I certainly think many Iraqis would tell you that they are worse off. And most Iraqis will tell you that it's a good thing that Saddam is gone, but that the conditions today are terrible. And they have been terrible ever since the invasion. And many Iraqis have told us that it was a matter of time, maybe a couple of years, that Saddam would have been undermined. The sanctions were weakening his government. The inspections were keeping tabs on what was going on. The U.S. knew before the invasion that the Iraqis were not an imminent, that Saddam was not an imminent threat to the United States. I think that, you know, the information that has come out since has borne that out. So what have we created? We've created chaos. Insecurity. People are getting kidnapped on a daily basis for ransom. You know, cities are being bombed. It's the infrastructure is in complete disrepair. And so, how are they better off? Under Saddam's time, people could walk on the streets 24 hours a day and not without fear. No question that he was not a great guy. But on the international front, he was under control, and it was a matter of time. His government was weakening, and this could have been done in a different way.
We hear the talk constantly, Gail, about we're bringing democracy to Iraq. Is democracy something that the Iraqi people have sought? Is that really what they're seeking? And what is their understanding of what democracy is?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and I think it's there would be many responses. I think that in general you can't bring democracy on the end of a gun, and I don't think it's something you can impose from the outside. It is something that develops within, and we have created a situation where sort of an organic, natural development, political development, can't happen. And we, when it does happen, we intervene because it doesn't quite fit our model of things. So, you know, we want to put in a government that will be friendly to us and friendly to our policies in Iraq. And it's a terrible situation.
George Bush is now saying, basically trying to lower expectations for the what's going to happen after elections take place in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Do you see elections taking place, and what difference will the elections make, and what difference does the election will the elections make?
Well, it's, you know, it's not looking very good right now. There is a call for the Sunni call for the boycott. Mm-hmm. So that means that how can these elections be legitimate under these conditions? How can you hold elections under a military occupation? Number one, you know, the government that's responsible for organizing these elections is not considered to be a legitimate government. So how can you hold legitimate elections under these conditions? There's going to be huge numbers of people who either will refuse, to participate either because they're afraid or because they don't believe that they're legitimate.
Well,
how can you consider these to be legitimate elections? They're probably going to push them through, but the results are going to be, you know,
illegitimate, considered illegitimate by just about everybody that's observing.
Pretty much, yeah.
And in terms of the fear piece, because we have about 45 seconds here, with this latest attack on our soldiers that killed 20 soldiers eating a meal,
mm-hmm.
how realistic is it to expect that any Iraqi person is going to take
to a
yeah go to the polls under those circumstances?
No, I mean poll workers are being killed, you know, every week. So it's a very difficult situation. We've created a disaster that's going to last for generations to that's going to take generations to fix.
And Gail, how can people get to your organization, Code Pink?
We are on the web, and you can donate to the humanitarian effort directly. It's www.codepinkalert.org.
Gail Murphy, happy holidays, and thank you so much for joining us on the Wake Up Call.
Thank you for your interest in the story.
Very good.
Listen, take care. Happy holidays.
Thank you. Listen, folks, we'll be back with Dr. Geeta Rao Hoopa, the president of the International Center.
You're listening to the best of the Wake Up Call. Stick around for more following the top of the hour news, your local news, and the ABC News. This is AM 920 WGNU.
Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Some very sad news for all of you, the people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. That progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. You pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing your wound below me.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Feel me, brother. Stop resisting.
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it.
A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment.
And so we say to all in this nation who would dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air.
I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below me.
That not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it. A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal. Yet many are denied equal treatment.
And so we say to all in this nation who would dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
Thumping Talk Radio with Brett Rosen has a new time, Tuesdays from 10 until noon, right here on AM 920 WGNU, where we discuss the issues that matter most to you.
For the issues that matter most, it's AM 920 WGNU, Granite City, St. Louis.
Here's the latest from ABC News. I'm Daria Aldinger. The crowds may not be what they were last year, but immigration reform advocates are counting on large gatherings today and events from coast to coast. Alberto Huerta is with the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights in Atlanta.
We want to make sure that everyone's included and integrated into our society because we're all neighbors, community members, and family.
More from ABC's Alex Stone.
Schools here are urging students to attend classes today, but several immigrant rights groups are calling on students to boycott schools so they can take part in marches and rallies. Here in L.A., police are getting ready for 500,000 protesters. Similar marches are expected around the country.
What they'd like to see is a new legal path to citizenship in place before the next presidential election. President Bush is on his way to CENTCOM for a progress report on the war in Iraq. ABC's Ann Compton is making the trip with him.
Now, 4 years later, President Bush will spend this anniversary with his Iraq commanders at their home headquarters in Tampa, Florida. When he returns to the White House, he says he will veto the congressional bill for a timed withdrawal from Iraq.
And tomorrow, the president will be getting out that veto pen to use on the bill Congress passed last week to fund the war, which demands troops start to come home this fall. Gas is inching up to the $3 a gallon mark. Now, analysts say $4 a gallon gas is not out of the question. More from ABC News national correspondent Jim Hickey.
Thank you for calling the Energy Information Administration's price hotline.
The hotline has the bad news.
The national average
average price is $2.971 per gallon.
Just a dime short of a record. The average price, say some experts, could shoot to $4 a gallon this summer. It's a supply and demand issue, and analyst Peter Butel says we need to cut demand.
If we could just cut 4 out of 100 trips, that would make a huge difference at the pump.
But he says that sort of thing won't happen until we start paying around $3.50 per gallon. Jim Hickey, ABC News.
ABC News Money Scope. The Dow is up 20 points, NASDAQ down 3. This is ABC News.
Order! Order in the court!
It's time to render your decision. You've made up your mind, but you're twitching from the itching, squirming from the burning, and everyone's hanging on your every word.
I should have used Preparation H. Quick recess!
Where's he going?
You should carry Preparation H portable wipes, the discreet way to get big relief. They're convenient little packets that hold very big wipes, so you can cleanse, cool, and soothe to get relief even when you're not at home.
Order! Now, my decision.
Preparation H portable wipes. Big relief to go. Uses directed.
Today, many advances in technology have benefited the field of criminal justice, and new jobs are emerging. How can you get involved? The ITT Tech School of Criminal Justice. With a degree in criminal justice, you can pursue various career opportunities involving corrections, workplace security, and private investigations. Call now for an ITT Tech brochure. 800-ITT-3169. That's 800-ITT-3169. Not offered at every campus. Check the ITT Tech for a list of programs offered.
You've heard of senior proms before, but probably not like this.
Norma Baker of Sutton is one happy young lady. She and her husband Norman have a special evening ahead.
We are attending our first senior prom.
The two of them were supposed to go to the senior prom in Sutton 62 years ago, but a war got in the way.
He was in Iwo Jima, and I decided not to go.
But tonight, the Sutton High School Honor Society and high school band will host a senior prom for a couple seniors who are proving that the knuckles of love keep knocking after 6 decades of marriage.
You still in love?
Yes.
Carl Stevens, ABC News, Boston.
The University of Mary Washington is looking for a new president. The man who had the job has been fired after 2 drunken driving arrests in 2 days. Police say William Frawley drove home one night without a right front tire. Larry Burke heads a step closer to taking his Nana Nicole Smith's infant daughter home. The photographer's attorney says the child now has a U.S. passport. I'm Daria Albinger, ABC News.
Now, the local report from the WGNU newsroom.
Good morning, St. Louis. This is Patrick Brandmeier with your WGNU news update for the 9 o'clock hour. In the news this Tuesday, a tow truck driver is dead after allegedly being hit and killed by a tractor trailer. Authorities are questioning the driver of the vehicle over the incident on Interstate 270 near Manchester. 32-year-old Aaron Helfrich of Festus was loading an abandoned vehicle onto his flatbed when he was struck. The tractor-trailer driver did not stop, but he was found at a contracting company in South St. Louis County. Investigators aren't sure if the victim was hit by the cab or the truck's extra-wide load, or if the driver even knew somebody was hit at the time. Ameren and the Department of Natural Resources are at odds over the reopening of Johnson Shut-ins. The park was heavily damaged in late 2005 when the Tomsawk Reservoir collapsed and flooded the area. The Department of Natural Resources says the park will remain closed this summer because the restoration is not complete. Ameren says that enough repairs could be made to open the park by July 1st. Finally this hour, Cardinals pitcher Chris Carpenter will throw a simulated game in Milwaukee today as he prepares for his return from the disabled list. Carpenter says he felt no discomfort in his right elbow after an aggressive bullpen session last weekend. He hasn't pitched since a rocky start in the season opener last month. The team's coaches and medical staff are encouraged, and manager Tony La Russa says he has a very lightly penciled date for Carpenter's return to the rotation. That's your look at local news for the 9 o'clock hour. I'm Patrick Brandmeier, bringing you the news that matters most to you.
Good morning, St. Louis. 6 minutes after the hour of 9 o'clock at AM 920 WGNU, I'm Howard Morton. Let's take a look at this hour's traffic and weather. Southbound 270 from St. Charles Rock Road through Dorset. Look for an earlier stall. Cleared just south of 70. Traffic's easing by. Northbound 270 between Gravois and 44. Look for that traffic to be easing as well. Northbound 141 from 55 through 44. Look for slow traffic. Folks are avoiding 270 if at all possible due to earlier tie-ups. Westbound 5570 from Tudor into the Poplar Street Bridge. Look for that traffic to be easing. Westbound 64 from Ball Avenue in the 5570 split is starting to ease up there as well. Westbound Kingbridge traffic is moving well into the landing. Westbound 40 from Hanley through 170. Road construction, one lane is closed. Eastbound 40 between Brentwood and Hanley. Look for the same thing going on. One lane closed due to road construction. Westbound 40 from Hampton through Oakland. The road is reduced to two lanes. And eastbound, pretty much the same thing, is reduced to two lanes from Oakland through Hampton. And westbound 70 from 5th Street in the 94. Look for some slowdowns there as well due to road construction. That is a look at your traffic. Now let's take a look at your forecast for today, tomorrow, and for Thursday. For today, partly sunny this morning, mostly cloudy by the afternoon. Chance of showers and thunderstorms, highs in the mid-80s. This evening, showers and thunderstorms likely, low around 60. Wednesday, showers and thunderstorms likely, with a high in the lower 70s. And Thursday, pretty much the same. It'll be straight through all the way, showers and thunderstorms through the week. Currently at studios of AM 920 WGNU, we have 75 degrees under overcast skies. Lambert Fields reporting 76. Stay tuned for more of Liz Brown and the award-winning wake-up call. Actually, it's the best of the wake-up call. Liz Brown will be live in the studio beginning at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. Until then, we bring you more of the best of the wake-up call. This is AM 920 WGNU, where the issues matter most to you.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brothers, talk to me, sisters. I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brothers, talk to me, sisters.
Time for us to use our power. Please do not beg folks for power. Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Some very sad news for all of you, the people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. I will never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. If you pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below me.
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it.
A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment.
And so we say to all in this nation who would dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters in a long and difficult struggle.
Now the best of the wake-up call.
Down the chimney tonight. Hurry. Tonight.
Oh, welcome back, welcome back, welcome back to the wake-up call. This is Liz Brown living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number. 454-6609 is my fax. You need to get up and you need to get to me. We have much, 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 much to talk about. And I don't know, for the last few years or so, I have not really talked a lot about environmental issues on the show, and it's for a personal reason. It's just too awful. It's just too awful, the things that are happening in our world. And I know that I often bring you information that is bad. And sometimes bad news has a way of paralyzing us and not allowing us to move forward. But we're going to have to shake that off, because when it comes to our environment, we have to deal with it. We really have to deal with what is happening today. And so, having said that, know that the following conversation is not going to be good news. It's not going to be good news at all. But it certainly should be a wake-up call to you about the issues that are confronting us. I have with me this morning Nancy Stoner, director of the Clean Water Project at the Natural Resources Defense Council, joining us from Washington, D.C., to talk about something that the EPA is getting ready to do. Nancy, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm just fine, thanks.
Good. Nancy, there is very little good news in coming out of the EPA nowadays. Talk to us about what the EPA is getting ready to do with regard to sewage.
Well, the first thing I actually would like to do is start with a quote, and I'd like you to keep this quote in mind as you hear about this policy change. That Teddy Roosevelt, President Theodore Roosevelt, said in 1910, civilized people should be able to dispose of sewage in a better way than putting it in the drinking water.
Mm.
That was 1910. Now it's 2004, almost 2005, and EPA has a new policy that would make it legal for sewer operators to dump inadequately treated sewage into our waterways to put more bacteria, viruses, and parasites in our drinking water and in the waterways where we fish and swim.
And, you know, given the viruses that exist in 2005 that didn't exist back when Teddy Roosevelt was president, we should be terrified at what the possibilities of outbreaks, the possibilities of disease, the possibility of death, of dumping today's viruses into our waterways.
Absolutely. According to experts, there are about 8 million Americans now who get sick every year from waterborne diseases.
And that's just water turning on your tap and drinking the water.
No, it's not just that, actually. It's that plus swimming in contaminated waters and eating contaminated shellfish. There's a lot of ways in which the pollution that we dump into the environment comes back to haunt us. And this is an estimate, because we actually don't have very good data about what causes the illness. Most people who get sick from waterborne illness get gastroenteritis. So that's stomach ache, diarrhea, vomiting, fever, very unpleasant. But most people recover. The people who don't always recover are the elderly, small children, cancer patients, and other people with weakened immune systems.
And we're also talking about the water that's used to water our produce as it grows?
Absolutely. But, you know, the thing about water is, of course, we all learned in elementary school, is it's all connected. You discharge the water, whether it's into the rivers, into a wetland, into a lake. It sinks into the groundwater. We pump it up for irrigation. It's all of a piece. And so if we contaminate any of it, it will have downstream effects.
So talk to us about the policy that existed before. What is the EPA changing?
Well, the current law says that sewage has to be fully treated whenever it's feasible to do so. There's an exception now for emergencies. So, you know, if there's a hurricane in St. Louis, if there's some kind of extreme rain event, then the sewage doesn't get fully treated. It's recognized as an emergency, not feasible. So we're not talking about emergency situations in here. What we're talking about is changing that rule. So instead of a presumption that the sewage goes through the whole treatment process, it no longer would in a rain event if either the pipes or the sewage treatment plant were overwhelmed. So what that, of course, does is create incentives not to have good, strong pipes, not to have adequate capacity throughout the system.
Mm. Let's talk about the actual treatment process. So, and I want people to really be clear on this. For the last 50 years, the sewage treatment involved like a two-step process. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes. The first process is solids removal, taking out the larger solids that are in sewage. The second process is biological treatment. Essentially, they use bacteria to eat the sewage in the second treatment. And then sometimes also there's a third step in the process called disinfection. That's where usually chlorine is sprayed on the sewage to kill pathogens. What this policy would do is say when it's a rain event again, of any size, the second part of the process could be skipped. So solids would be removed, but the sewage would not go through the biological treatment, which is actually what removes the largest amount of the pollutant load. And then disinfection is not necessarily required either. Just the fact that you're skipping the second process doesn't mean that you have to do disinfection. It varies from place to place. And I actually looked at the comments that the St. Louis Metropolitan Sewer District filed on this policy. They support it. And they said in particular that they objected to having a requirement that disinfection be done every time the sewage was not fully treated. They called that a dangerous precedent.
Oh, Jesus.
Which, it's just amazing to me that the notion that not disinfecting they would think is dangerous, whereas we all would look at it completely the opposite.
Because that's the way that it is. That's the way that it is. So they're saving lots and lots of money by not having to treat this sewage.
That is their motivation. Their motivation is to cut corners and save money. And the reason is because we are not investing enough as a society in our water and wastewater system.
Oh, wait, I want to back up just a little bit, Nancy,
okay,
because we didn't get to the second part of what they're going to do. They're going to blend the stuff that they don't treat now into the water, right?
What they do is they take the sewage that's coming in during the rain event that's dilute because of how much rain leaks into the pipes, and they will skip the treatment process on that other than the solids. And then they mix it with the fully treated sewage. And they do this mostly as a means of meeting certain limits. The limits that they have, you know, at the end of the pipe, just before they discharge, are averages. They have 7-day averages. They have 30-day averages. And they use dilution to meet that. They use this blending of the two sewage streams to meet that. And they use averaging over the week and over the month to meet that. So they're actually putting a lot more pollutants of all kinds, ones that rob the water of oxygen so fish can't breathe, ones that cause nutrient pollution, which, of course, adds to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, and then all the pathogens, the viruses,
and
the parasites.
Let's talk about the pathogens. What kind of pathogens are we talking about that are going to exist in our water that didn't exist a month ago?
Well, first of all, I do feel like I should address the timing. This hasn't happened yet.
Okay.
And I'm actually trying to stop it. So I'm hoping that the answer will be none.
Okay.
Okay, but if this goes through, it will put more viruses, like that cause, for example, hepatitis, put more E. coli bacteria. We'll put more cryptosporidium, which, of course, is what killed almost 100 people in Milwaukee in 1933 when the drinking water became contaminated. We'll put more Giardia, and those are parasites, and they are not removed very well at all by the treatment process when secondary treatment is skipped. In fact, disinfection doesn't work very well on them either. So all of those types of parasites make people sick, as I said, usually with gastroenteritis, sometimes also with respiratory illness, but very serious kinds of diseases like hepatitis, like cholera, that kind of thing can occur. And it is most threatening to those who don't have strong immune systems, and those people can die.
So where are we in terms of the place, where are we in terms of this legislation? When is a decision going to be made on whether or not the EPA will be able to reverse this policy?
Well, it's not a legislative proposal in Congress. It's completely up to the EPA whether to do this or not. And this is a policy that's already been put out for public comment. Last year it was. 98,000 people wrote in, almost all of them wrote in and opposed it. The sewer operators and a number of cities do support it, because it saves money, as we talked about, in the short term, although it passes on costs to the public, I think. But that happened last year, and now basically the agency is ready to move forward. They're briefing political people. As you may know, Administrator Leavitt is leaving the EPA. That may slow it down a little bit. But I think we're likely to see a final decision early next year.
So early in what year? 2005. So early in 2005. What do you recommend that people do?
Well, one thing that they can do is to call their legislators. The EPA has not heard from anyone in the Missouri delegation yet on this issue. And there is a letter being circulated by Senator Jeffords from Vermont right now. So
they haven't heard from Congressman Clay, they haven't heard from Congressman Cleaver, they haven't heard from any of our other congresspeople.
They haven't heard from any of them yet. They did hear from 64 members of the House last year. As I said, there's a Senate effort right now, but the House members from Missouri are not on there yet. And so calling your representatives and say you want them to weigh in, I think that would be very helpful.
And what's the language that people should use when they call their congressperson or email their congressperson and ask them to weigh in on this issue?
They should call it the blending policy, because that's what EPA calls it,
okay,
the proposed blending policy, and they should let them know that that they want to have their waterways protected, they want to have public health protected, and to do that, they want full treatment for sewage. And let me just say that really is not a lot to ask, I don't think. This is part of the Clean Water Act that was passed in 1972. This is not, you know, extreme, you know, environmentalism that we want to have sewage treated. This was something that we decided upon as a society more than 30 years ago. And at that time, it was very well-established technology. And so what we want to do is make sure we have that basic technology in place to protect public health. I happen to have the Capitol switchboard number here with me.
Very good.
202-224-3121.
One more time, please.
202-224-3121.
And when they call that number, what do they ask for?
Well, they ask for their representatives.
Okay.
They ask for their senators or their representatives in the House.
And that this is the blending.
Proposed blending policy.
With the EPA.
That's correct. Sewage blending.
Very good. And I want to thank you very much, Nancy Stoner, Director of the Clean Water Project, joining us from Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Happy holidays.
Bye-bye.
Listen, folks, Liz Brown, Wake Up Call. We're taking a break. When we come back, we'll be here to take your calls at 454-0400, 1-877-920-WGNU. And
you're listening to the best of the Wake Up Call. More coming up following these messages. This is AM 920 WGNU.
Thumping Talk Radio with Brett Rosen has a new time, Tuesdays from 10 until noon, right here on AM 920 WGNU, where we discuss the issues that matter most to you.
What America needs is affordable health insurance. Finding affordable health insurance for you and your family, it's on everyone's mind right now. If you're self-employed, it's on your mind too. One of the things we face as entrepreneurial Americans is finding affordable health insurance. Well, I've found a company you can call right now and get affordable health insurance. Midwest National Life Insurance Company of Tennessee. Write this number down. 877-652-7793. That's 877-652-7793. Midwest specializes in helping entrepreneurs of all kinds. Those of us who run small businesses or don't get health insurance where we work, to protect our families with affordable health insurance. Call 877-652-7793. Not available in all states. Association membership is required in most states. Home office, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Exclusions and limitations apply.
Children will always outgrow us. But for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children has doubled. A problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children will use them. Log on to earthshare.org today and find out how you can help. A public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
Anywhere in the world at WGNU.net. The award-winning wake-up call with Liz Brown.
Liz Brown will be back tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. live in the studio. Until then, more of the best of the wake-up call. This is AM 920 WGNU.
Baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight. Hurry down the chimney tonight. Hurry. Tonight.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back to the Wake Up Call. This is Liz Brown, living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is the phone number. 454-6609 is the fax. And my toll-free long-distance number is 1-877-920-WGNU. That's 1-877-920-WGNU. We have much, much, much to talk about. 454-0400 is the phone number. Let's get it done here. This is our last hour for today, so let's have a conversation. It has been reported that there are many more and more people are being infected with AIDS, and while we've heard statements like that, what you may not be aware of is how AIDS is impacting on women and girls. And we need to talk about what that impact is, what the impact means, and what's being done to address that. And to do that, I have with me this morning Dr. Geeta Rao Gupta, the president of the International Center for Women's Research, joining us from Washington, D.C. to talk about this. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Doctor, talk to us about the impact of AIDS on women and children. Most people, I think, would be surprised to find out that one of the fastest growing groups of people infected with AIDS are women, and let alone girls.
Yes, but that's the reality, and it's the truth. Globally today, there are about 14,000 people infected with HIV daily, and half of those currently are women and girls. And in sub-Saharan Africa, of all adults living with HIV/AIDS today, 60% are now women, which is a much larger percentage than in the past.
How did that happen?
Well, women and girls are much more vulnerable to getting infected than men and boys. They're physiologically twice as likely to be infected from an infected man than a man is to be infected from an infected woman. So physiologically, they're more vulnerable. And then there are a range of social and economic factors that contribute to their increased vulnerability that I can tell you more about.
Let's talk about those.
It's basically, in most societies around the world, there is an unequal balance of power between women and men, where women have less access than men to jobs, to income, to credit, to ownership of land and property. They have lower status in society. They're dependent on men. They have less access to education. And there's plenty of data to prove that those gaps between men and women persist around the world, in almost every country around the world. And it's that inequality that contributes to their vulnerability in this epidemic, because it makes it very difficult. For example, the economic dependency makes it difficult for them to negotiate protection in a relationship because they have no leverage. The threat of abandonment, the threat of destitution are very real and immediate threats that they have to face while negotiating safer sex with their partners. So that's a big factor, the economic dependency. Secondly, they don't have the same access as men and boys do to information and to education. So just knowing what can protect them is not always available to them. So that's the second factor. And the third most important one is that the current prevention method that is most commonly used in this epidemic, which is the male condom, is a male-controlled technology. Women can only plead with their partners to use one. But when they're economically dependent on their male partners, it's difficult to have any leverage in that negotiating. And so they don't have a method that they themselves can use, and as a result are left sort of open to the risk of infection much more than boys and men are.
Well, doctor, if the issues that contribute to women contracting AIDS mm-hmm. are about economic dependency, educational access, and prevention, mm-hmm. Where do you start? How do you, what do you start with
right.
in addressing this issue? Because this is societal. This is those things are just as true in New York City as they are in Darfur.
Absolutely. And in fact, I often say that we are paying the price for allowing those inequalities to persist for all these centuries. It's our legacy from previous years, and now we pay a price for them, and it's a steep price because women and girls are dying from this epidemic, but so are men and boys and children, and entire communities are being wiped out. So while the underlying factors are huge, as you say, they're sort of societal inequalities, it's time to address them, and we know how to do it. These are not, this is not a problem without a solution.
Well, how
We know that, for example, we know that if women have ownership and control over land and housing, they are more likely to be able to negotiate protection successfully and less likely to face the risk of violence, domestic abuse. We know this through research evidence.
So what do you do, though? I mean, do you go into a country and you say, okay, what we're going to do to fight AIDS is we are going to advocate for, create legislation about giving, turning over more ownership or ownership period of land to women. Is that how you do this?
Yes, you do. You work with communities and women's organizations and governments in countries to help them see the evidence about the links between these different issues and impress upon them that in many of these countries, actually, there is legislation that allows women to own property. It's just not enforced because nobody thought it to be very important or thought it to have any consequences for society. But now it does. So it's a question of ensuring that the enforcement mechanisms are in place and that joint titling. You know, it's not that women have to own it alone, but if what we're pushing for is that women and men can jointly own property so that when a man dies of AIDS, the widow and the children who are left behind do not suddenly find themselves homeless because some other family member, typically another male relative, grabs the property and land. Because it's that kind of immediate and extreme destitution and poverty that perpetuates a cycle of infection and disease, because then girls and women are left with no option but to sell sex for money, and their daughters are left very vulnerable to sexual exploitation, which perpetuates the epidemic. So it's legislation, it's legal literacy and informing communities of the need to give women these rights now, enforcement mechanisms which are possible to do, you know, educating the judiciary, making sure that police mechanisms are in place for enforcing these rights, making sure that we have paralegal workers who are available in communities to help women and men who are affected by AIDS write wills that are legally viable so that women and orphans can, in fact, own the land and housing that they live in.
So which is more difficult, or which is more of an impossible task, getting a society to change their sexism, or getting them to confront how to deal with AIDS?
I think that because the two are now so interlinked, I'll tell you a story. I worked with a research team in India in a low-income community where we were trying to convince parents to allow their daughters and sons to go through a sex education program. And as is typical in most societies, the parents in that community said, there's just no way we're going to allow that because it will make our children more promiscuous. You're teaching them things they don't need to know. This is nothing that we need. Please leave. And so we set about a very long education process trying to inform the elders in the community about the need for them to have this information, because when they're married, they are likely to be exposed to infection and have very little control or an ability to be able to protect themselves, particularly their daughters. It so happened that in the middle of those education sessions, a young man who belonged to the community returned home from a foreign country where he had been working, infected and very sick with HIV, and ultimately died in that community. And for the first time, that community saw the face of AIDS and the horrific death that involves, and began to ask more questions about what was the link between access to that sexuality and HIV prevention infection information and protecting their children and their daughters. And once that information was provided to them, fathers stood in line with their daughters wanting to know why their children could not be enrolled. So change can happen. It's a horrible, tragic thing to say, but because the epidemic is causing such devastation in communities, people, that it's actually an opportunity to bring about a change in gender inequalities.
One of the third area that you talked about was the use of the prevention,
right?
That it's male control. The condom is really depends
male
upon
male method. Yes,
yes, that's a male method. What do you teach young women and girls outside of that? Because in here in this country, that's all we hear is the condom.
And that's the only method that's the most prevalent and popularly used method. And it should be made more available, and girls and women should have access to it and be taught about it. But simultaneously, there is now the female condom. I don't know if you've heard of it. It is available in most pharmacies around the U.S., but it is what I call a boutique method. It is too expensive and available to too few in the developing world.
And there's a lot
pushing for it to be, for the price to go down.
And also in terms of the use of it, people are far more familiar with how a condom works as opposed to how
a female condom
works.
That's right.
So there's going to have to be a larger educational process that goes on with that.
Absolutely. But in the developing world, women have found that they often don't have to use it. They just have to have it there with them, and producing it and saying, you know, I'm going to use this if you don't use the male condom, often results in men using the male condom.
Oh, okay.
It just gives them an option, which is a very important option. The second thing that I want to talk about is that there is a big movement now to develop microbicides, which are a range of substances that women can use to protect themselves from HIV. It's something that women can apply topically. And that exist in the lab. There are 60 such compounds that are known to have an effect to block the virus, to kill, inactivate or kill the HIV virus. But in the lab, we do not have not had the resources all these years to conduct the clinical trials in humans to test the effectiveness of those compounds. And
so what are you advocating?
We are advocating for more resources for those clinical trials to occur quickly, because there is the possibility that you could have a microbicide that's about 60% effective in about 5 to 7 years.
Mm.
But it needs resources. Clinical trials are an expensive business.
Now, women do not contract AIDS simply through sexual activity. Women also are contracting AIDS. In fact, a lot of women are contracting AIDS through needle use.
Yes, that's true.
Can we talk about that?
You know, infected needles for injecting drug users is a mode of transmission as well, and an increasingly virulent way in which the infection is spreading.
When you say
sexual transmission is still the major mode of transmission around the world.
Well, it's my understanding of the numbers here in the United States that amongst people, women of African descent, that the major way that they are contracting AIDS at such a rapid rate is through the needle use.
Well, it's actually not that easy to differentiate between needle use and sexual transmission.
Mm-hmm.
It's sometimes the needle use of their partners that then infects the partner, which then gets transmitted to them through sexual interaction. But yes, injecting drug use with infected needles is a major mode of transmission here in the U.S.
And that the way to deal with that is really rather easy, isn't it?
Yes, to provide clean needles.
And what kind of resistance are we seeing within this country, and then what kind of resistance are we seeing around the world to programs that push clean needle programs?
Well, I'll tell you that around the world, in countries that are heavily affected by this epidemic, needle exchange programs providing clean needles for injecting drug users is actually acceptable and is being provided as a public health measure. In this country, there's enormous resistance to it because people feel that it's somehow encouraging drug use. The point of the matter is that we have to think of this epidemic as a public health disaster, and we have to find ways to contain it. And harm reduction is a very important way to contain it. If we know that we can get injecting drug users clean needles and that will help prevent the spread of this infection, it can help not only to contain the epidemic, but it can also help you to interact with injecting drug users and convince them to get enrolled into programs, into rehabilitation programs that can help them with their habit. But somehow there is a resistance to that, and it's a resistance that's similar to adolescents getting sex education.
Well,
these are all societal hang-ups.
And we need to take a break. I am talking to Dr. Jita Rao Gupta, president of the International Center for Women's Research, joining us from Washington, D.C., to talk about the AIDS crisis and how it is taking such an enormous toll on women and girls all around the world. Doctor, when we come back, I'd like to talk about how race factors into this, the impact of AIDS based upon people's race. Women's race. My name is Liz Brown. This is the Wake Up Call. I will take a break here, and then after that we will be back. Stay with me.
You're listening to the best of the Wake Up Call. Stick around for more following these messages. At the top of the hour, we have ABC News, your local news, and your weather, as well as Head Thumping Talk Radio with Brett Rosen. That's on the way. This is AM 920 WGN.
I'm Phil Person of Person Roofing. We've been in business about 17 years, and we've advertised on WGNU almost that whole time. We have installed over 5,000 roofs in that period of time, and today I have a customer here. His name is Mr. Merriweather. Mr. Merriweather, I think we installed a roof on your house about 10 or 12 years ago.
Yes, you did.
Recently, you had a little storm damage on that roof, didn't you?
I sure did.
Can you tell what happened?
Yeah, Mr. Person come out and repaired my roof and didn't charge me anything.
And you haven't had any problems since we did a repair?
I sure haven't.
Even though your warranty was out, we still came out and took care of your roof.
Right.
We try to service our customers, and if you would like to have a new roof, call us at 361-7127. That's Person Roofing at 361-7127. All phases of roofing. Thank you.
Hello, I'm John Womack. I have a new show on WGNU called On the Table. Some of the things we'll talk about will be restaurants, food and wine trends, recipes, but really, we're just trying to help you experience great food and wine, whether you're at home or out on the town. So if you love great food and wine, you'll love On the Table. Be listening every Tuesday at noon here on WGNU.
Every day in Missouri, over 200 calls are made to the Child Abuse Hotline. The St. Louis Crisis Nursery needs your help to lower that number. The nursery is dedicated to raising awareness about child abuse and neglect and needs your help. With the support of our community through donations and volunteer time, the St. Louis Crisis Nursery will continue to care for children in crisis. For more information, call 314-768-3336 or visit crisisnurserykids.org. Together, we can ensure our children will not spend their adulthood overcoming their childhood. News to you from WGNU.
Are you one of those people who look at somebody who's big boned and think that's just a euphemism for Twinkie enriched? Are you sick of the idea that we can go to war in Serbia and bomb the crud out of them, but we should stay out of Iraq? If the whole entire pop culture thing, Britney Spears, Super Bowl commercials, and all that stuff gets on your nerves, well, guess what? It gets on mine, too. So if you want someone to listen and understand, listen to me, Brett Rosen, every Tuesday, 10 a.m. on WGNU, 920 a.m.
Big Brother is watching, and we're watching Big Brother. It's the award-winning wake-up call with Liz Bryan.
Now we take you back to the best of the wake-up call right here on AM 920 WGNU.
Welcome back, welcome back, welcome back to the wake-up call. This is Liz Brown, living my life as an African and loving it. 454-0400 is my phone number. 454-6609 is my fax. I am talking to Dr. Geeta Rao Gupta, the president of the International Center for Women's Research, joining us from Washington, D.C. Doctor, welcome back.
Thank you.
I am looking at this article out of the Washington Post from yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And the title of the article is Dying for Basic Care. What the report is saying, this is a report that came out of the American Journal of Public Health, is that between the years of 1991 and 2000, almost a million people of African descent died, and those were deaths that could have been prevented if people of African descent had had the same care, health care, as white people do in this country. We're talking about the issue of AIDS, and do we see those same types of disparities? Is that one of the reasons why women, people of Hispanic or African descent, make up less than 25% of the female, U.S. female population, yet they account for over 82% of the AIDS cases in women?
It most certainly is, because racism creates the same kinds of inequalities as sexism does, and in fact interacts with sexism to fuel poverty and a marginalization in society that keeps these groups of people away from or restricts their access to information and services that you know others take for granted. That is why you see, and it's you know, you can see it so vividly in that statistic that you just mentioned, that why is it that African American and Hispanic women account for 83% of AIDS cases among women when they're only 25% of U.S. women in total. So,
Did you find that number shocking of the report that I just told you about?
It's extremely shocking, and it was wonderful that the Post highlighted that, because access to health services in this country, we talk a lot about the broken healthcare system, but we don't quite understand the consequences of it for large subpopulations in this country. And it is a tragedy that a country that is the most powerful in the world is unable to ensure that its people get full and equal access to health services.
We were talking on the way out about needle exchange programs and the resistance to having those programs here in the United States. Are you aware, doctor, of any place in the United States where those needle exchange programs are taking place? And could you give us a little bit more detail about how those programs operate?
I'm not an expert on needle exchange programs, mm-hmm. but I can tell you that you cannot run those programs through federal grants.
Mm-hmm.
There are private organizations that do run those programs. I'm aware of one in New York City.
Is it working?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It works well if it's done well. We've learned a lot through experience on how to make it work well.
And what are the components of a program that works well?
It is to know, you have to have the information on how you can reach a community of people who are severely stigmatized and discriminated against in society for their drug habit, and how to gain their confidence so that they know where to come and at what time to be able to get their clean needles, how you provide, use that that sort of moment of interaction you have with them to provide them the information and education they need, and the referral services that they may need to get the treatment if they so choose to get it, and the counseling that they may need. But it's harm reduction as a method in public health is essential, and I think that the federal government not providing support for those programs is short-sighted.
And do you see a change in that regard based upon political party, or is it just something that is cultural in the United States that there's such a resistance to that?
There has been a resistance to it for quite a while, and I think that science must win over ideology, and I think that the scientists in this country and all of us public health professionals must prevail. Must find a way to prevail. It's not a battle that we've given up on. The resistance is understandable. It's not something you should scoff at. It is difficult to understand how this will not just be perpetuating a horrible habit and spread this kind of drug abuse in the country. But the fact that there is a way to be able to contain not just that habit, but also the spread of HIV is an important thing for people to understand.
And doctor, let's move to the continent of Africa for a moment, if we might. The numbers that are coming out of Africa about the infection rate are staggering in many cases. But yet a story just came out last week about how this country, through this current administration, used medicines that they shouldn't have been using, in fact that they knew would be cause harm to people in the continent of Africa, thereby creating, again, a more distrust of the use of any kind of medicines. How do we fix that, and why should anybody from the continent of Africa trust that the medicines that are being brought to them in the name of AIDS are not going to be used for making them into guinea pigs?
I don't know what story you're talking about, but I do know that the U.S. provides, through its President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief Program, treatment, care, and prevention programs for communities all over Africa as well as Asia and the Caribbean. And I know that those programs in the majority, I mean, treatment is a big part of those programs, mm-hmm. and the U.S. has imposed some conditions on the types of treatment that can be made available. They have to be FDA approved. They have to be U.S. drugs. And they are making them available to the extent possible in all of the countries. I don't want to put too negative a spin on this because You have to understand the treatment was not at all available even 5 years ago in many countries in Africa. The fact that more people have access to treatment today than ever before is a cause for joy.
Well, actually,
and is a huge step forward.
Well, actually, this is a story that came out of South Africa. In fact, the major, the leading party there in South Africa has written a letter to the United States outraged about the medicines that were part of the recent program funded by George Bush to get medicines, a certain medicine, into Africa, and that medicine, it now turns out that our government knew that it caused more harm than it did, than it didn't, and they are outraged, and they were calling it allowing African people to be used as guinea pigs.
That's terrible if that's true, and I don't feel competent to comment on that since I don't know the details of that particular incident.
So what are there some of what? But you do acknowledge that there is some suspicion in terms of drugs that are being brought into to other countries that and how do you fight that type of suspicion that comes with that?
Well, I'll tell you that in the communities and the places that we work, people are very keen to get treatment. And to get treatment that's cheap and affordable. And any program that makes that possible, obviously quality treatment, not any old treatment, that works, any program that makes that possible and shows hospitals and the medical staff in African countries how to, you know, sort of create treatment regimens that people can adhere to is what they're looking for. So any program that does that is a good thing. If there is suspicion on the part of Africans towards towards sort of programs offered by the U.S., I don't see that in our daily interactions with teams that we work with. You know, this is an epidemic where people are looking to cooperate, looking to find solutions together, looking to have science lead the way rather than ideology. To the extent that ideology stands in the way, that's a dreadful thing and must no longer do so. But that's the spirit that we encounter in our interactions with our African partners.
You've been listening to the best of the wake-up call. Liz Brown should be live in the studio tomorrow morning beginning at 6 a.m. Up next, it's ABC News, your local news and your weather, followed by head-thumping talk radio with Brett Rosen. I'm Howard Morton. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Nobody is going to give it to you. You were born with power.
Some very sad news for all of you, the people who love peace all over the world. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
Never say that progress is being made. If you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. You pull it all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound that's below that the below me.
I think I'm hearing revolution in the air. Tell me, brother, how is this?
But the hard truth is that not everyone is sharing in this city's splendor and glory. There are more poor than ever, more families in trouble, more and more people who need help but can't find it.
A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself.
We believe that all men are created equal, yet many are denied equal treatment.
And so we say to all in this nation who dare listen to us, black, white, Jew, Gentile, Asian, Latino, that we are brothers and sisters.